41?
Yeah.
31.
Or is it 42?
I just made a folder for 41. But like, it would be...
Let's roll with it. It's episode 41, everybody. Hello, welcome to Friends Per Second. This is the podcast, a bi-weekly podcast, where we talk about video games, we get together, we talk to interesting people. I'm Jake Baldino. I'm joined, as always, by Lucy.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm great.
In person.
In person. Yeah, another in-person pod. Ralph, how are you?
I'm good, good. Very excited to be here. 32 hours it took me to get here. I love Australia being the arse end of the planet. It's fantastic.
It's a long plane.
It is the longest plane rides of all.
Where are we? What are we doing?
We are in Boston. Wait, how you say it?
That was good.
We're in Boston, Massachusetts. Is that how you say it? Massachusetts. Yeah. Yeah. And we are currently at Ghost Story Games Studio. We're like sitting right here right now.
They let us borrow this room.
Yeah, they let us borrow this room. We are here to play Judas for 5 hours and then to speak one-on-one with the game's lead, Ken Levine, for an hour and a half. That is what is happening. It's crazy. We got the invitation to do this a while ago, and there were obviously lots of back and forth discussions to like set all this up. But yeah, finally came to agreement on all of it. And
we paid our own way.
We did.
We dragged ourselves here and we got to see a version of the game, not a full preview event where it's like they fly out press to like check out a game. This is still very much a work in progress thing. So we're not making like huge judgment calls on
something.
We can't just be
so
like, it's
much
bad.
Is going to change.
And I guess that's something that we really want to drill down on and be really clear about. This is not a preview. Like previews are a point in time when the game is kind of pretty close to finish.
Curated experience.
Very curated. And they welcome people in. They're like, yeah, give us the pros and cons. Talk to your audience about what you like and don't like, whatever else. This is a pre-preview in the sense that the game is still, it's not at the point where you can really assess it. You know what I mean? The purpose of this discussion is not to provide like critical feedback on the game. It's really to talk about like, well, what is this game? You know, like what is it aiming at? What's it built on, etc. And then that allows us to have those sorts of conversations because this game is very surprising, if you know what I mean. Like, it's, we were not anticipating. Like, you think this is BioShock in space when you start playing, and you're like, "Hey, it's BioShock in space." It's definitely not BioShock in space. It's got a whole bunch of other shit in there that is not what you'd expect at all. Mm-hmm. And I guess this conversation is really just about what are those things, and then having a chat with Ken about like, well, why did you make those decisions? What are you aiming at here? So that we really want to pitch that what the purpose of this discussion is as separate from a typical preview.
Yeah. Also, it is significant because up until this point, none of us knew what the game is.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what we want to focus on is like figuring out what it is. Like they, you know, us speaking to them, it's like the first time we really have this info. Anyone really has this info. So
that's the thing, going back in, you know, we were coming here. I was looking at the trailers that have been released and the very, very short PlayStation blog post doesn't really tell you much. And so, you know, they didn't give us a presentation. Typically when you come to events like this, they'll have this presentation. It's like, you will see this, this, and this. Nothing. Like they said, hi, here's what you're going to be playing.
Then we played it.
See ya.
Yeah. And we played like a full 5 hours, by the way. We played from the very beginning of the game.
Jake didn't move.
By the way. Jake didn't get up for five straight hours.
Ralph and I, proper gamer.
Yeah, you guys keep getting up. I'm like, what are you guys doing?
I had to pee.
No.
You just sat and you were like,
yep. I was like, no, we it's got like games.
He was like on a winning, like at a blackjack table on a winning streak. I'm not getting up, man. I'll break my streak, you know?
So we do have a really interesting conversation with Ken. But this first part, we want to kind of dive into what the game is and like some top level thoughts. The one thing I think I wanted to, I'll just start if you guys don't mind. The thing that came across for me, the biggest thing I kind of came in expecting was like the Irrational, the BioShock, the Ken Levine and his teams, like their touch on story and really how that was going. And not that I got what I expected, but I got something. I got what I was looking for. They're being creative. They're trying different things with storytelling. And that's very apparent from how characters appear on screen and deliver their dialogue as you walk around to the main character herself, how she's presented. There's a lot going on story-wise. And like that's, I touch on that first because like that's always like my favorite thing about a game.
Yeah.
I think definitely you can see the kind of you know, when you are Jack in Bioshock, you are this nameless, quiet man. And then Booker, obviously being voiced by Troy Baker, there's a lot more to him. But even at the end of the game, when you start to see his face more, it feels weird to see Booker's face because you don't really associate him. And so even immediately, you see Judas's face a lot in reflections.
Yeah.
And they're really doing this really cool thing to sort of ground you with that character and get familiar with her. But to your point about kind of the Bioshock of it all, a big Bioshock fan, it felt like I kind of knew part of the language of the world already in terms of things that I could interact with. Even the way that you get, so if you've seen the trailer, that you'll have a kind of power in one hand, a weapon in the other hand, and immediately I'm given firepower.
Yeah.
And immediately I see two enemies standing in a pool of oil. And I just...
That's how we do that.
Absolutely. Yeah, chain reaction. Yeah. Thing. I mean, and popping audio logs as well.
Yes.
There is a lot of that. But then what I really like is, so a lot of the game is centered around the big three. There are these three important characters that essentially there's like a favorability rating. And like you can choose to like start doing one's missions, but then the other one will get pissed off. And the game's big thing and Ken's thing that he's kind of been pitching is like how all that stuff intersects and how it changes the game, how it changes like what they say to you. So you're dealing with these characters pretty constantly. Yep. Their presence is very frequent and it kind of does a thing that like we've seen in other games where a character will like blip and teleport right into the environment and they're sitting on a table and they're talking
Johnny
to you.
Silverhand.
Johnny Silverhand, the Joker in Arkham, in Batman's head, spoiler alert. But here it's like a very not static thing.
So you can walk around and they will zip and change.
They'll keep, so like they'll fizzle out. If you just keep walking down a hallway, you'll hear their dialogue and then they'll zip and they're leaning up against the wall and then it'll fizzle out again and then they're sitting on top of a crate.
Yeah.
Or if you, before you open a door, they'll be on the other side of the door continuing the conversation. And that is a really interesting thing for like how, you know, the audio logs in Bioshock was like a significant thing. Like it just really worked for that game and it pushed a lot of that story. For this, I just thought that was cool because I had to like retrain my gamer brain because when a character appears and they start talking, I just stop.
Sit
there and talk to them. But the game like wants you to keep playing and you can move around and the characters are still there delivering like expressive dialogue. And I thought that was cool.
So we haven't really set up the conceit of the plot. And we're going to spoiler free as much as we can. But basically, it's kind of the end of the world. And one man has seen it coming. Through an LLM.
AI, basically. You use an AI predictive model to predict the end of the world.
Yes. So. And so basically, rich man decides to save humanity and sends people up into space to try and find a new planet, a new golden world. And as with all, you know, we've seen it happen with Rapture. We see it happen with Columbia. Goes to shit very quickly.
Yeah.
And so that's the ship that you're on. That's the Mayflower. And as Judas... You are suffering from memory loss.
Yes.
Which is, I kind of love that because, you know, you as the player don't have any concept either of why you're there. And so you kind of are discovering it at the same time as she is. And you've done something bad, not entirely sure what.
Very bad.
But, you know, there's no one really on the ship anymore. And the mission to save humanity to get to Proxima is, it can go different ways. And that's where the big three kind of comes in because they each have their own way. They want to either complete the mission, ignore it completely. And that's when it gets, what in terms of narratively, you know, making decisions and then seeing the other two react to your decisions in various ways, either by digging at you and making, oh, you're doing that, are you? You know, like just the base level to actively sabotaging you or the ones that you've kind of aligned with will help you out. And so the thing is that we played for 5 hours and I feel like I've barely seen where that's going to go. It was towards definitely the latter couple of hours of my playtime when I started to see more of it happen and more of things having an impact. But yeah, I'm really intrigued to see just how many repercussions that's going to have.
Yeah, I think in terms of setting up a foundational understanding for what this is, it's very, it is a starting point is BioShock in space for sure. Like you feel that the setup that you've got there with like this guy's name's Rosenberg. He's a, you know, rich dude who wants to do a big thing and he did the big thing. And now look at all that's happening around it as a result of it. Right. And the visual language of the Mayflower, the ship that you're on, is unmistakably, you know, like BioShock-esque, even though it's a different architectural style, it still has the same sort of impact on you that that does.
Yeah.
And in terms of its narrative approach, and it's just, it feels unmistakably BioShock. You've got the weapon and you've got the powers in hand and, you know, that immersive sim combat thing going on all the time.
It's different.
Yeah, like those, all of those things absolutely exist. So at a starting point, if everyone was to ask, is this BioShock in space? You'd be like, yeah, sort of, absolutely, right? But then you start getting into that other territory where the big three really represent a different approach that they're taking in terms of how you advance this game's narrative. Where rather than a single narrative that unfolds and you just go beat for beat, there's potential storylines that evolve based upon who you align yourself with. And if someone like Hope, the redhead girl, is like, come and do this for me, and you're like, yeah, all right, I'll help you out for a bit, and you do like a mission or two for her, then at that point that starts to open up new narrative rewards. She tells you about herself. She tells you about why she did the things that she did. She starts warning you about the other big three, and this emergent narrative starts piecing together. And if you then decide to switch your loyalties and go with Tom for a bit, the colonel, whatever, you know, maybe he's very hostile with you at first because you've been helping out Hope. And so, but then you need to kind of warm him up. And then after a while, he starts to thaw and he starts to give you some story stuff and whatever. So the narrative approach to it is very different. And all of that stems from this kind of narrative Lego GDC talk that Ken gave years ago, which is about like building blocks in games and combining them in different ways to create these outcomes, right? This is probably going to sound very surprising, but this is a procedurally driven game. And I would never have guessed that walking into this. Like,
no. I mean, the first couple hours of you're getting in there, very linear. Obviously, there are things and mechanics that the game has introduced.
Ken does in the interview too. Like, he speaks to like the nuances of that procedural where there's some subtleties to it. But yeah.
It is, yeah. And that is it's a really interesting form of procedural generation and the approach to it, right? Because it's not just, you know, what I described there with the story, and it's like competing factions or whatever. It's also about the core level design where they have designed tile sets that have multiple sockets, and they basically dynamically plug different assets into these sockets to create different environments, right? And that have a different look. So they've got different themes they can apply to them on the fly. That's one thing. They've also got this procedural approach to combat where the game, if it notices that you're really into stealth, then it's going to start giving you more encounters that are challenging for that style of play and reacting to that. If they notice that you are reliant on a certain type of weapon or power or whatever, one of the big three might start dangling incentives in front of you that are going to make that easier, like that style of play easier to accomplish, right? So the whole thing is, you know, trying to respond to you, trying to adapt dynamically as you move through it with these procedural levels that load up on the fly, and also responding to your choices narratively, also responding to your choices in terms of gameplay, right? And it's too early. I think with 5 hours, we can't really assess whether or not that's really like coming together yet because we're really early on in the piece, right? But that, all of those pieces, I would say this, I didn't feel like I was playing a procedural game because we've played those sorts of games before. It very much felt to me it still had that kind of very curated feel that I got when playing BioShock games. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like it still had that. And I think that was what was so fascinating to me about that. I was like genuinely surprised to learn that some of the things that I experienced were procedurally generated because I was like, wow, I didn't think that that would be the case, but it was.
And we haven't talked about the biggest surprise is that it's actually a roguelite.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is very, very, very stunning, to be perfectly honest. The first time I encountered that, I was like, I died. And then it's like, you've just lost all your stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wait, what? What do you fucking mean I lost all my stuff? And yeah, you basically, when you die, you get booted to this space, which we won't talk
about.
We won't spoil.
Because it's a really cool concept for how it's framed.
Very interesting idea. But you do get booted and it has its own kind of story arc that unfolds. And so, you know, when you die, it's not like it's punishing in the sense that, yeah, you lose all your stuff and you're like, ah, fucking hell, that's annoying. But you get, on the flip side, the narrative that unfolds in that space continues to progress. And so death doesn't feel quite as punishing as a result of that. So
and it's also the place where you can decide, oh, I'll have another weapon slot or something, or I'll unlock a certain ability to come into the
that
game.
That meta progression stuff within the roguelike.
It almost felt like a very, very light. Like in terms of like I made significant progression and, you know, died once. It's all about like balancing and tuning things. And it's another thing where it's hard to talk about because it is early. But I still felt like I was overall progressing through a linear action adventure story based game with like missions to go do in different places. And then occasionally I would be reminded like, oh, yeah. There are these persistent, like, under the hood elements, and like, okay, cool. So, like, when you do die, it is kind of like, oh, all right, yeah, it's been a minute. So, let me now I can make my character a little, you know, have more health or have another weapon holster or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely, it's been a very surprising, like, day, you know, playing through that game because you really did. I really did go into it thinking, cool, Bioshock in space, I'm down for that, right? And then you understand, and then you encounter that rogue light structure, and you're like, shit, I didn't expect to think the encounter that at all. And then you learn about how much of what you're experiencing is actually procedurally generated, and you're like, what the fuck? You know, so I've never played a game quite like this one. I don't think there are anything, you know, like this is a AAA procedurally generated narrative-driven first-person shooter with roguelite elements. That is ultimately
a lot of
words. That's a lot of words altogether. And it's a really ambitious mix of genre and also mixing in some new stuff that we kind of have never really experienced before. So I found it really fascinating to figure all that out. And I think that's one thing. It's still going to take people time to really kind of wrap their heads around that. You know, like we're going to talk about it here now and then whatever. But when you start playing this game for yourself, whenever it comes out, it's still probably going to take you a bit of time to figure out what exactly this thing is. And because there's no easy reference point that you can point to, be like, oh, it's like that game.
There's definitely bits and pieces you can pick from other games, but there's nothing quite like what this is throwing together.
Yeah.
And I still don't know. Like, I don't know how I like ultimately feel, but where I am just really vibing with is how characters speak, emote. Like if you were into, I'd say like if you were into how Elizabeth looked, animated, spoke, it just felt kind of different. That's kind of like on overdrive here with all the characters. And then the presentation, the music, a lot of like really interesting cutscenes and just like how they play with everything. Like that stuff so far is already like working for me.
Yeah. Totally.
I also think as well, I mean, you know, Rapture and Columbia were as much a character in their games. And the Mayflower as well is... I really want to know more about it because I love sci-fi. I have a Blade Runner tattoo, man. Sure. I was like, and so there are questions in there about artificial intelligence and social standing and currency and public shaming. There's a lot of, you know, as you see the artwork and, you know, like in Columbia, all of the kind of propagandary posters and keeping people in line. It's very confronting. And I want to see where that goes. Cause there's one sequence that we talk about in our chat with Ken where it is this big public shaming.
You can catch glimpses of it in the trailer.
Is it really? Is it in there? Okay, right.
Where they're throwing likes
and
down. They're
throwing likes and it's not exactly subtle. But it's interesting because I think much of the society seems to be it's very clearly focused on order, social cohesion, and compliance. And, you know, one thing you, as you're exploring, you'll actually see little notes that you can click on and they're essentially tweets that pop up and they have someone saying something and it has like a like and dislike, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down count next to it. And if someone's saying something on message, you know, it's getting lots of likes. And if someone's being subversive by being like, maybe we don't trust the powers that be, everyone's like dislike, you know? So it's not subtle, but it's interesting because it's clearly setting up this world that is very much about like stay on message or you will be judged
on the mission because you know it's kind of the fate of humanity. But also, I mean, do you see that Black Mirror episode of
I don't even watch Black Mirror.
Nosedive, the Bryce Dallas Howard one.
Is that when the guy had sex with the pig? That's the only
episode.
No,
that's the first episode. Okay. No, this
sorry,
is the,
excuse me.
No, it's a similar one where she is this upstanding member of society, and then through a series of events, she loses her status because she's being downvoted and everything.
Right. Okay.
And Judas is, so there's the pilgrims yes. who are upstanding members of society, and then there's the violators, and Judas is the bottom of the bottom.
Yes.
And it's, you know, the disparity between the two is quite wild. And I'm,
for sure.
I'm really intrigued by that because, like, So You've Been Publicly Shamed is one of my favorite books. It has changed the way that I interface with social media. And actually, we were talking to Ken about it. He has also read it. And right. so I'm really intrigued to see.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Mayflower as well structurally is a really interesting place because don't imagine a single contiguous open world. Nope. The opening sequence is a single space that you move through. But then after that, it's fun actually. There's a dog, a giant dog, robot dog, and he is the means by which you move through the rest of the space station.
He's like a bathysphere from Bioshock, if you yeah. want to use that analogy, but yeah. he's a dog.
Yes, he is a dog. You literally climb into his head. It's like a big glass dome thing.
Yeah.
And then you, at that point, a little overworld mini map pops up that you can kind of direct him around.
It's like stylized to yeah. fix a lot.
And you need to like maintain his fuel levels as you're moving, like collect fuel pickups as you go across this mini map or whatever. And that you can then choose where you want to go to next. And then you load in, it's pretty quick. And then all of a sudden you take a step forward, the lights come on in this new space and it's in front of you and you're now in the commons or the birthing district or something.
Oh, the intimacy district.
Intimacy
well.
District.
Everything is controlled.
Yes.
And so there's, the farming district, like the milk stuff.
Yeah, the milk district. Yeah, I saw that one as well. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I mean, at that point, and the framing of that is very Bioshock-esque because it has these big sort of, the moment where you kind of look up at the statue. You
and,
know,
the, and the lights yeah. click on. Clap. Yeah, it's yeah. just like, yeah.
It is totally that.
They know what they're doing.
And so they really lean into that heritage without feeling like they're just kind of copying the ideas, I think. Yeah. Like it yeah. has, the art style is unbelievable, by the way. Like I think we'll talk about enemy design, but stylistically, it's just so striking the whole way through. Everything we saw looked incredible. Mm. But I think the real standout was just the enemy designs that were... The, crazy.
A dentist chair
yes.
that comes at you and goes, time for a filling.
And it's a dentist chair with like, you know, a little bit of like anthropomorphic, like, so it's got like a face decal on the headrest, yeah. but it's also usually like a dead person corpse is in the chair
yes.
and then the chair stands up and it's like hugging the dead corpse in it as it's coming at you with yeah. needles. Really cool. Really creative stuff.
Yeah. It is.
It's engaging with them all, the enemies. It's because it's early.
Mm.
Is that like it's hard to judge how exactly high level encounters go down.
Sure.
So I'm curious to see how this progresses because in five totally. Hours the progression, and again it's something that they can tune. Progression was pretty slow.
It
didn't
was,
get
yeah.
a ton of upgrades. It took a while, and I'm curious to see how like a full blown stealth encounter with me having an invisibility cloak or a second air dash or telekinesis. Cloak?
Yeah, there's an invisibility. Yeah.
I didn't get that.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things that you unlock. The way you unlock upgrades in this game is by doing something in the world. So there's no talent tree. There wasn't a talent tree that I saw, was there? No.
I don't believe so.
Yeah, so basically you'll shoot a canister that's next to some enemies, okay? And then at that point, the canister explodes, enemies die, but the game kind of slows down and all this binary code pops up on screen. And what's happening is that Judas is like having an idea for how she wants to create an upgrade. And so at that point, you go over to the corpse of the enemy you killed, you do this brainstorm thing to hold down a button, and you can see she sort of thinks through like, what if I added this to my gun to do that? And that then gives you like some sort of mini side questy thing, challenge, I should say, where it's like kill three enemies with canisters. And you're like, okay, cool. At that point, you unlock a new upgrade for your gun or a new ability. And that is how I got Cloak. I forget exactly what I did to trigger it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did something and that was how I unlocked it, which is great because it's so surprising to go through this world and find upgrades that way. Mm-hmm. Where usually it's like, oh, here's the menu and I know the next 50 things I'm going to click on
the
over the next whatever.
Be here.
Yeah. Whatever. And it's just to have them as a random surprise. You don't know they exist. You don't know that they're coming. It's a really nice way to go about it, I think.
Ultimately, though, it does, like you unlock the ability to then go and craft that weapon.
Yes.
So there are crafting components
yep.
and I didn't have too much of a connection to those components.
Sure.
So that's another
like
balancing
mushrooms
thing.
And stuff, and I was like, oh.
Yeah, I think I think that's to do with the roguelike thing. And I think coming back to what you said, we were 5 hours in and we'd unlocked so little, made so little progress. I get the feel, and Ken says that this game is much larger than the previous games they'd worked on, right? And those games usually clock in at what, 15-ish hours? 15 to 20. I definitely can see how this is a lot longer than that because we did 5 hours. And I mean, I've seen in the trailers the number of weapons that are unlocked and the number of abilities that are unlocked and hacking thing. And that's another thing we should talk about, the hacking.
Yeah.
We had unlocked only a fraction of that after 5 hours, you know? So I can definitely see how this stretches out much, much longer.
And also in terms of like some things we didn't get to see yet, but we know that they're going to implement like puzzles and stuff. Like it is going to have places where it's like, oh, you need to flip this switch, but then what does that turn on? And how do you get through these lasers? Like stuff like that. So with that, the hacking, I do think is really cool. It's another thing I only was able to scratch the surface on, but I like the way it's implemented. Yeah. So
no pipes.
No pipes. It's like almost like weapon wheel abilities where you'll press a button, you'll see an enemy across the room, you press a button to then hack them. And then if you're playing on controller, you rotate both the sticks to select different things. It's two things. So it's an if this, then that, which is so smart. Yeah. So it's like this enemy will terrify this enemy, or this enemy will power down, or you make this enemy attack this enemy.
Spill oil.
There's the ones with like the deputies where these like they're the horse enemies. And there's one hack called socialize, where you can say socialize with another deputy and then the two horses will like meet up and start playing cards together. You know what I mean? Yeah. So
I loved cool. Kamikaze. I would, because stealth fan, I would hang back, hack one thing, usually the biggest enemy in the room, usually that butcher boy, and I'd hack him to go find the nearest organic or robotic creature and self-explode.
Yeah, right,
and
nice.
And I would just do that all the time. Yeah, but by defeating those enemies is how you would get those hacks, or you could craft them. There's things called eggs. So no circus of values. No.
Damn it.
I know.
Shame, I miss his voice so much, so good. Yeah.
But no, so there's a thing called egg, and you find all of these components throughout the world, and then you have to kind of decide what you want to...
That is something, resource management... Pretty tense, pretty tight.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was really overthinking every single one.
Conserving my powers, conserving my ammo as much as I could. Survival horror.
That's it. Don't think of this as an action game. I mean, it is, but like it's got a lot of its focus is about the tension that comes from managing your resources over time. For example, there's no heal, like no ability to heal. There's no health packs.
God,
okay.
That messed me up.
The only way to heal is on each level that you load into, there's one healing station. That's it, right?
And it's one use.
And it's single use only. So the tension here comes from how well can you manage your health? How well can you manage your ammo? The decision to convert your resources, do you use those to craft a valuable upgrade or do you use them to craft more ammo, right? So this is... Yeah, it's not just a run and gun action game where you're just shooting everything you see. Most of the time, you're going to want to stealth. You're going to want to hack. You're going to want to use your powers to be more economical with your resources. And I just found that really interesting to engage with because it's, I don't know, much more interesting than just shooting everything, you know?
Yeah.
So, anything else we missed, you think?
I don't think so. Oh, the music.
Oh, man, so good. So good.
Yeah. So, you know, if Bioshock Infinite had, you know, memorable music moments.
Yep.
This one definitely did. There was one in particular that I just had a really big smile on my face.
Yes, definitely. It has musical numbers, but also the combat music is this really kind of hi-hat led, you know, like...
It's Whiplash. It's
very Whiplash.
Yeah. It's cool.
It's fantastic. Cool. Every time combat kicked in, I loved it. And then after when combat's finished, you can just hear the music really clearly, hear the hi-hat coming down and you're just like, yeah, man.
Yeah.
The game has just tremendous style,
it's
visually.
It's definitely its own thing.
Oh, absolutely. There's nothing quite like it in terms of its composition, I would say.
And voice acting. All the actors and actresses so far, really good. Yeah. Really compelling.
Totally.
A lot of unknowns in the cast too.
Yeah. Ken was talking to us about that. Not in this discussion, actually separately, that he's pulled in a lot of people have never worked on games before, you know, and they're just like, just likes what they've done in other places. So,
For me, I mean, I guess like questions that remain is, does it all come together?
Yeah.
And in terms of the narrative Lego thing and like your decisions and like the different characters reacting to you and, you know, what does that look like 10 hours later,
definitely.
15 hours later. That's the stuff that we don't know yet.
Yeah, and that's also not even the stuff that had we played 10 or 15 hours, we can't really comment on yet because the game is still very much being built. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's where it's at in terms of its life cycle. But I'm just really interested in the ambition behind it. Like I genuinely am interested to see, Can you pull this off? A AAA first-person shooter, procedurally generated, responsive narrative, like roguelite elements. Can you put all of that into one blender and make a smoothie that tastes good? Don't know yet. But I will say that, you know, at a high level, I certainly had a good time playing it for 5 hours.
I would like to play more.
There's no doubt about that, you know, and I was very just intrigued by the things that it was doing and saying. And very, very keen to see more of it for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well, I think with that, maybe we roll it over to our interview, our discussion with Ken Levine himself, leading up the game, leading up this team at Ghost Story. So we will roll that now.
Vivisection.
No, we're rolling with this. We're keeping it in. What is it, Jake? Tell us.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Raycon, the handy dandy, easy to use earbuds that go with us pretty much everywhere. They have good quality sound at about half the price versus other premium wireless audio brands. I've been using these things for years now at this point. Mm-hmm. Do you guys like throw a pair of these in your bag or what?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I actually have multiple pairs because I have like one in my gym bag that I just keep in there because like just never want to forget them accidentally or whatever else, and like one in my travel bag. And yeah, so I mean, they're always fantastic. For me personally, I like them because they actually stay in my ears. Mm-hmm. As I've said this before, my ears are massive. My head, very large head. That comes with large ears. And so most earbuds actually fall out, but Raycons, like the way they're shaped, they stay in. And I've always been super happy with them. They're just like, they're old reliable. You know what I mean? Like they're dependable. They get the job done. And yeah, I think they're very, very solid.
Yeah. I mean, for this episode, we went to Boston and then I came back and I went to Boston again and came back. And so for me, having a pair of earbuds that is not going to die somewhere over the Midwest is fantastic. Totally. And so that 8 hour playtime is fantastic. I listened to a lot of podcasts.
The capsule that they come in is actually really small as well, whereas most of the other ones are much larger. So they fit really easily in my pocket, which I really like. I've always been happy with them.
Yeah, the big thing is that they just check all the boxes, man. They like different sound profiles, pairs up with Bluetooth, nice and easy. It's got awareness mode, noise isolation mode, like that stuff is really useful. It like you can pause, take calls on it. Basically everything you would need a pair of smart earbuds to do, they do it.
For sure.
Yeah. So go to buyraycon.com/friends today and get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That is 20% off buyraycon.com/friends to score 20% off and free shipping.
This episode is also brought to you by AG1. Look, being healthy is really tough, obviously, especially for us who play too many video games. But there should be one thing every day that you do for yourself to make yourself feel healthy and also be healthy. And for me, and I know for the other guys, that's been AG1 for quite some time. It's one scoop mixed in water once a day. And it leaves you feeling energized and ready for what's ahead. Jake's got it right there. You can't really see it if you're not on YouTube, but he's holding up the AG1.
Yes.
Yeah. So you guys have been drinking AG1 for a while now?
Yes. Yep. Immune support, gut health, all that stuff. It really helps lock it in the morning as a lazy gamer. You know, like you said, one scoop water. That's very easy for me. I don't like complications.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think if I were left to my own devices, I would have, you know, blood like pate and just, you know, severe mineral deficiencies. But
yes,
and I'm always like really put off by how complex like taking minerals and making sure your nutrition is up to scratch can be. But just doing one scoop cold water, super easy in the morning, setting myself up for a good day, feels really good. And that's why we've been partnered with them for so long.
Yeah, we have. It's also a very rigorously tested product. They know what they're doing. They've been on the market for a long time now. They're very trusted by a lot of people. So if you go check it out online, you're going to see a lot of very positive reviews for it. It's sort of been a part of our routine for a while now. We really like it and we definitely recommend checking it out. If you are someone that wants to focus on your gut health or overall nutrition or just adding something to your day where you know you've done something good for your body, AG1 is a really good option. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1, try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase at drinkag1.com/friends. Keep it in. /friends. That's drinkag1.com/friends. Check it out. Thank you very much, AG1, for supporting the podcast.
Mr. Ken Levine, how's it going?
It's going great. Good to be with you guys. I've been a fan of the show for a while now. So
it's very exciting. It's always weird when we hear people, like developers, watch our show.
Yeah.
It's a very strange experience to hear that. So
it works because I think you guys get into a you get into the conversation, you have developers on the show.
Sure.
And it's interesting for developers because you guys are talking about things that are, you know, relevant to developers, and you're not talking on a more surface level.
Sure.
So I've been enjoying the show for a while.
Thank you. Appreciate that a lot. We enjoy your games.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah. So we're kicking it off with Judas. I mean, you're kicking it off. The game was revealed at the Game Awards, but this is the first time you're really talking about it.
Yep.
So how does it feel? It's been a long journey. You've been just like, you and your team have just been in rooms working on this. How is it?
It feels really good. The 10 years is a long time to not talk about things, and because you, and for the team, especially for me, it's not that bad because I've enjoyed not being public for the last 10 years. It is my favorite part of development is not the, you know, the press stuff. It's being in the studio and making the game. You know, I'm not one of the developer who likes traveling the world and, you know, hobnobbing with celebrities and things like that. Cause I really just like working on the game. And so it hasn't been that bad, but I think it is hard to, when people ask you, so what have you been up to every Thanksgiving? You're like, well,
can't say.
So it has been a little challenging for the team also, especially it's tough. And I really appreciate their patience because we didn't want to go out and just be like, oh, we're making this game and talk about it in a high level or show CGI trailers or just do a lot of sort of hype about it. Cause I've sort of been down that road before. And I kind of felt that it's not really what the audience wants. And, so, you know, we tried to do a very different approach, but that meant the game being pretty far along before, very far along before we, you know, were able to have conversations like this.
Mm. So can we dig into that journey? So, you know, 10 years, Infinite shipped, DLC is shipped. Where did Judas kind of come from? Have you been working on it that whole time? Did you take any time off after Infinite? You know, how did you go from one huge, very intensive project to another?
I think I've got like a psychological problem that I think if I ever stop, it's all going to go away. And I love making games so much. I think, you know, my biggest terror is that I won't, because it's my hobby and it's my, you know, my passion and it's where I find a lot of meaning in my life. You know, my meaning is basically coming from, you know, my wife and my dog and my work. Mm. And so I think I do have this sort of irrational terror that if I stop for a second, it's all going to stop, you know.
As content creators, we can sympathize. Oh, don't worry.
Have to upload. You guys can't like miss a week because your audience, like, where are they?
This is going to turn into a therapy session.
And that's a bit irrational, but so no, I really didn't take a break, and I probably should have. I've never really taken it. I'm in almost 30 years now. I started in a year, it's going to be 30 years. And I've been, I started Looking Glass. And I think that, my poor wife, you know, like I've started doing things like every year we go to Florida for 2 weeks now and rent a house there, but I work half the time she's extremely patient with me with it. So I've gotten better. I probably didn't take a vacation really for the first, you know, 10 or 15 years really of my, or a serious vacation. It's really not a mental vacation from it. But on the other hand, I'm not complaining because, you know, I'm not Sunday night. I'm not like, oh, it's Monday. I got to go work. Yeah. I used to have those jobs. Yeah. You know, we were talking about this yesterday, you know, the day job. And I'm eternally grateful the fact that I have a job I'm passionate about, but the downside is it's hard for me to stop. So I didn't really take a break. I was already thinking about, you know, what was next during, you know, towards the end of BioShock Infinite. And, you know, part of that was sort of like what we didn't get to accomplish on BioShock Infinite. And so, you know, I started thinking about this, you know, not just what the next game would be, because that actually comes second for me. Usually I start with design elements, which is weird because I'm sort of known as a story guy. Mm. But, you know, even with BioShock, I started with the notion of like this concept of a predator and a protector and a protected class, you know, and I've told this story before. You know, I was watching some nature show and I saw, well, I won't get too into BioShock now, but usually I start with the design elements, you know, System Shock 2 is like, oh, what if we sort of merge, you know, RPG and first person shooter, you know, together. Yeah. And and this game was really came out of a lot of the frustrations I had with how narrative games were being built, how we were building narrative games and trying to think like, how can I achieve some of the objectives that I had in my head? But that was meant a lot of R&D and a lot of thinking, a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. So then, because obviously this has taken 10 years to get to this point, right? So why has it taken that long? Is it the case of that R&D and that early thinking took a long time before you could enter the sort of pre-production phase and you've been taking it slow? Like, yeah, what's that 10-year journey for Judas?
Well, one thing we had a relatively small group because I knew there was going to be a long period of as you said, R&D. Mm. And we had to build basically an engine on top of the Unreal Engine, which is, you know, this sort of, this narrative Lego thing, which is, was necessary for making the game. So before we had Judas or the Mayflower or any other of the things that you guys got to experience, we had this system. And I gave a talk about it at GDC about 10 years ago because I thought the idea was interesting enough that maybe other people could also kind of run with it because, I do care about game development. I'm primarily a single player gamer, so I really like single player games, and I knew there was a lot of threats to single player games because, the rise of, live service games and things like that, which are all, I'm different strokes for different folks. So that's, there's a lot of reasons those games exist, a lot of reasons they're successful. They're just not the kind of games I tend to play that much. So I tend to make things that are kind of games that I want to play. And I'm very eclectic in in the kind of games I play. So my games tend to combine, System Shock 2 is pulling from, survival horror. Mm-hmm. It's pulling from RPGs. It's pulling from System Shock 1, obviously. BioShock is pulling from, a lot of different sources. I tend to make games that, I get inspired by other people's work, and I sort of try to bring an eclectic, I don't even try to bring, I just end up bringing a lot of eclectic elements into our games, but it's always in the service of telling this particular story, this particular game. So I knew it was going to be a long time. So we had a relatively small team. We started with this concept of how we would build in this very modular way. But that took a lot of research and development time and a lot of, kissing a lot of frogs before we found the princes. But in general, the concepts, and you guys would be a better judge of this than I am because, you're encountering it new. I'm so close to it. Mm. The approach mostly has been successful in terms of achieving the outcomes we wanted and facilitating the kind of game development we wanted to do.
Mm. And I guess in connection with that, 10 years, so Take-Two was your publisher.
Yeah.
How have you managed to keep Take-Two on side for 10 years? It's like, that's a long time to be, waiting for a game to ship,
Yeah. Well, kids, ship some games that make a lot of money. And then that was, look, it's an issue of trust, right? Yeah. I have a good, very good relationship with, we're this weird little tiny squirt of a label at Take-Two. They have a lot of big labels and we're a one product label, Ghost Story, our own publisher, because Take-Two has this label structure. And so Rockstar is a publisher, 2K, Private Division, Zynga, and we're sort of this tiny little, bump on it. Mm. And I think that they know, my bosses know that new IP is really important. Mm. And they also know new IP is really risky. Mm. I think, I was very transparent with them about this is going to take a longer period of time. I think I probably didn't know exactly how long it would take. And if you had told me 10 years ago that, I'd be here 10 years from now, I probably would have started to cry. but it was necessary to get there, because it just was a very complicated, sort of technology task.
Mm.
But then you try a bunch of things, and once we had the basic technology function, we tried a bunch of things, applying game design to that. Some of it wasn't great at first, or most of it isn't great at first. In fact, we sort of have this internal philosophy, which is fail forward. Mm-hmm. You have to kiss the frogs, you have to fail. And then the question is, do you learn from the failures or do you not learn from the failures? So for the the longest time we've been, you know, bringing friends and family to look at the game, you know, even when it was the very early stages. And there were a lot of long nights of the soul. We're like, oh, you know, we're crazy here. Mm. But, you know, generally we, as a team, I think the team has been really good about, you know, it's, if you guys, yeah, one of the hardest things you can do is like put your baby in front of somebody and have them tear it apart. And we tend to do a lot of things where we put people in who test in very safe situations where we tell them you can't offend us. Sometimes we even do things like, you know, where we have outside people who are, you know, we're only seeing them behind the one-way mirror kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because you want that honest, brutal feedback.
Yeah.
And I think the team is very good at learning from that honest, brutal feedback and not getting defensive about it. Mm. And generally, every time we take that feedback and act on it, we've seen improvements in the next line of testing. So we've had a pretty good line in terms of people's reaction to the game, but we've been doing this for a while because there's a lot of, you know, theory is great, but in practice, you know, we have a saying here, and one of our pillars of the company is we're player facing, meaning the audience, we're not going to be there to explain the game to the audience. I used to joke about this with Doug Church when we were working on Thief. We used to say, we'll include a README file of why the game is fun. and because you're not going to be there. And that's really hard, I think, for especially for young developers, even older developers, more seasoned developers, to understand that we're not going to be there when the game, you know, we're not going to be there to explain it. You know, that's why when you guys played it yesterday, you know, I just stayed all the way.
Yeah, right? Like no presentation or anything. Yep. It was like, here you go.
Here it is. And the game has to speak for the game, or the game will speak for itself. And you can't argue with your audience. You know, like that's another thing I think young developers struggle with. They want to get into arguments with their audience. At the end of the day, the audience is going to buy the game or not. Mm. And so you have to be comfortable with hearing their feedback. And look, I think we all know that sometimes that feedback can get really unproductive and really nasty, but you're not going to change the world. So I just try to find, even in the meanest things sometimes, I try to find, can I learn something from this? And and you have to build the confidence of knowing I don't have to do anything they say. The audience is generally not going to tell you what to do. They're going to tell you what they don't like.
Yes.
And if you get consistent feedback of what people don't like, you better take that seriously.
As content creators with comment sections, again, we sympathize big time. So.
Yeah. It hurts, right? But it's helpful.
Yeah, it hurts at the beginning, I think. And you get used to it. And then you do learn that process of like, how do you internalize this and like wall off those emotions and be like, well, actually, I need to listen to X, Y, and Z. And I totally agree.
I would say, speaking of comments and stuff, some of the reactions to Judas when it dropped, it was like, oh, this is Bioshock in space. So what we were looking to get from you is why is it like being perceived, or why do you think it could be like Bioshock in space, but also why it isn't, more importantly?
Well, in some degree, you know, why it isn't is, I think, more, you know, you guys can tell me that from your experience with it. But I think that obviously I've got a particular, like, you know, like Wes Anderson or like Scorsese, I've got a particular eye, right? Mm. And I've got a particular taste. So a lot of my games have a lot of similarities. Like I'm, one of the reasons I think Bioshock holds up so well visually from what, I, you know, what people tell me is because it's not hyper realistic looking. Mm. So I tend to lean into exaggeration. One of the reasons for that is emotions project really well, you know, because we don't tend to do, I'm not, you know, Neil Druckmann does something a very certain way, which has a lot of cutscenes, and he's able to use that, and he was able to transfer that skill set to, you know, making the TV show. Mm. But I don't tend to do lots of cutscenes and things like that. So not a lot of close-ups on your characters' faces. Mm. So the characters have to project at a great distance. To me, the world is a lot of storytelling. So we don't control the camera in the world. We're not doing pre-play stuff. So the world has to, there's a lot of subtle work we do to make sure people see what we want them to see, even though we're not taking control of their head and pointing them in the right direction. Mm. So I tend to lean into exaggeration. I tend to, you know, I'm very sensitive to color. You know, I tend to, I grew up, you know, we were just talking about Spider-Man before. You know, one of the great things about that early era, am I allowed to get nerdy about superhero stuff?
Absolutely.
Oh, this is it.
You know, with, you know, like the Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko era is because the printing technology was so rudimentary, they had about 15 colors and the colors would just like draw a number of, you know, this is the color. They tend to deal in these very iconic looking characters with big, bold blocks of color. So you look at Elizabeth in Bioshock Infinite, she's usually a two color, you know, she's, you know, blue and white or gold, you know, so she has very simple color combinations because it reads. So there's a lot of things about what I tend to lean into exaggeration the same way Wes Anderson leans into, you know, formalism and symmetry and things like that, because it helps him. It's a lens he views the world, and it's a lens he views storytelling.
Mm.
That said, I think, you know, probably from the conversation, it is an extremely different game from the games we made before because of the very specific problems I had with the previous games in terms of their linearity, the lack of player real agency, and the world's ability to, like, you got to know Elizabeth really well in BioShock Infinite, but she didn't really know anything about you. She knew something about Booker, but she didn't know anything about the gamer, because the gamer really couldn't do much to change her perception. I think there, you know, we were talking about this yesterday. I think one of the biggest impetuses for making this game, we had a moment in BioShock Infinite where I was like, and this was late in development, I was like, hey, it'd be really great if, like, what if, because Elizabeth has a lot of emotional reactions to Booker's violence and things like that, and but it doesn't go anywhere. You know, she runs away for a period of time because she's so horrified by, you know, kind of what a monster he can be. But you, that doesn't, there's no point where she leaves, right? Where you do enough as she leaves. But I have this, I have this impulse in a meeting, like very late in the development. It's like, well, what if you could, what if she could say, fuck you, Booker. What can I curse?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, fuck you, Booker. You're a monster. I'm leaving. And then where would the game go from there? And because the way the game was built, which is essentially a linear experience that didn't have any real substantial ability to react to that kind of player choice, there was no way to react to the player in that way. And I found that frustrating. I found it to be a limitation. Not of the team or anything like that. Just I had sort of designed a certain game, but then in the middle of it, I was like, oh, I wish we could do something different. And that's where the sort of concept of modularity and Lego and all that stuff came from, is I wanted to build something where the game knew you as well as you knew the game.
We'll definitely get onto narrative Lego in a little bit, but I wanted to know, because we have been chatting yesterday, and I'm really interested in what things you consume outside of gaming and even in gaming that you want to, that inspire you and that have found their way into Judas.
So I think I've sort of draw from a weird eclectic mix of stuff, you know, like BioShock was, you know, I had read The Fountainhead and found it weird and strange and interesting and colorful. And so, you know, that very much informed, you know, that game. Also, but of course, in that game, Art Deco was a huge, you know, a huge inspiration for me. And just growing up, you know, I was born in New York, and growing up in New York, and my father worked in New York, and going to, you know, Rockefeller Center and a lot, and just being inspired by that feeling and the time period. You know, my family was, you know, a lot of immigrants from, you know, from Eastern Europe, and that whole, you know, diaspora thing. So, you know, and all the people, you know, BioShock is about, you know, it's a lot of refugees, right? It's people, you know, refugees from World War II, refugees from, you know, the Bolshevik Revolution. So I find all these weird things and I draw them, and I try to draw them in. And Infinite, I had been paying, you know, I'm a history buff. So I just sort of turned into like the Gilded Age and the sort of amazing technological advancements that happened. You know, in 1870, you're basically in a practically medieval world. And then you're like, then there's movies and airplanes and you know, tanks and you know, and electricity in a period of like 20 years. And so I was really interested in that kind of mix of the old and the new. I tend to watch a lot of movies. I'm a huge movie buff. And so, and then I play, you know, and so, you know, I tend to really like sort of auteur-y movies, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson and Wes Anderson and Tarantino and Scorsese. So I tend to be really drawn to that stuff, you know, really strange experimental stuff as well. This new Emma Stone film, Poor Things.
Poor Things.
Just watched that the other day. That's a wild one.
You know, just amazing.
Visually, insane.
Yeah, it's just, you know, his eye, he's so passionate about the visual.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I tend to like filmmakers who are passionate about the visual. And so, because I'm incredibly passionate about the visual. And, but then in gaming, I'm incredibly eclectic. Like I play almost everything. You know, I know I talked to some developers, like, oh, I don't have time to play games. And well, I guess I don't have much of a life outside of, you know, hanging out with my wife and dog. So, you know, I don't have a real big social life. So I tend to work and I play a lot of games and you know, my Steam list is just, you know, like
all of the things.
Insane. Yeah. And I'll play, I don't always finish things, but I'll play, I like just like trying everything. And when they have like Next Fest or something, I'll just download all the demos and play all of them. So I've been playing a lot of games, and a lot of the games that I've been playing over time, you know, I sort of draw them into what I'm doing as well. And, you know, there's a nod to so many games that I'm in debt to, you know, for all my games, but especially this game. And it has a pretty broad, it's probably the most eclectic palette of inspirations in Judas than any previous game. You know, I definitely understand people thinking that way. And we knew when we released those trailers that people might think that, because it is one of, you know, it comes from the heritage, the visual heritage, you know, of how I think about presenting information. But we didn't want to sort of then say, no, but it's also all these other things, because we wanted that really to come from people playing the game and allow, because me explaining it all or me promising it all, I didn't really want to be in that place. I'd rather, you know, just show it to you, to people like you, and to say, here it is, warts and all, you know, you tell me what you think.
We were talking with Jen, the person who helped set all this up, and she was like, you should ask Ken what the first line he wrote for Judas was. And we're like, all right, let's do that. So what was the first line for Judas, and why was it important? What was the first line you wrote for Judas?
Yeah, so this game probably is more drawn from my life than any other game I've ever worked on. And there have been some small things like, you know, the experience of growing up, you know, around New York and with, you know, with you know, sort of people came from Eastern Europe and all, you know, being very inspirational for Bioshock. But there's a lot of much more of sort of personal stuff in this game. So, you know, Judas was always a character. Well, not always a character. I was like, kind of, because we knew we had this game. We knew that we had a central character that you were playing, but I didn't really know anything about her. I didn't even know if it was him or her or anything like that. So I don't even know when this was, probably 6 or 7 years ago. And this is interesting because we had several years before we even knew any of that stuff. I was on a run. And I tend to do a lot of thinking, you know, on my runs, and I bring a voice, you know, I bring my phone and I have a voice recorder, and I wrote this first line, which just sort of came to me, which is very much sort of similar to like my own sort of personal life, is I don't like eating in restaurants because I don't like interacting with waiters. And she goes on about how she likes eating from vending machines because you don't have all the awkward interactions and you might not say the right thing. And, you know, she's somebody who like goes over those conversations in her head a lot afterwards. And so just by, you know, and that, okay, with a character who's really comfortable with machines, but really not really bad with people. And, you know, one of the great things about machines, your computer never gets mad at you. You never say the wrong thing. You know, you never think afterwards like, oh, did, you know, I don't know, did Microsoft Word, you know,
I don't know. I say please and thank you to Alexa.
Like, is that weird? That
it feels, yeah. No, people have commented that. And I said, that's well, weird. In the Robot Uprising, I'll be okay.
I respect you.
No, it's weird. I found myself doing that sometimes too, and especially now with like ChatGPT, and it's sort of weird insistence on like apologizing and being very human, and sometimes you know, chastising you for asking it questions. Yeah. It's a bit creepy. I'm not a fan of, you know, I'm not a huge fan of that. I kind of tell them, shut the fuck up. Just give me the answer.
Sometimes they reply like, that's not very nice.
Yeah.
Which I didn't ask.
Which I think is not really a great, you know, a great approach. You really want to separate out, you know, the men from the machines. But I understand the comfort, and I think I'll, you know, I think this is not uncommon with gamers. I think, you know, my Atari was my best friend when I was a kid because I didn't have a lot of friends. So I spent a lot of time, you know, playing, you know, combat. There was an old, you know, one of the first games was combat, and there was no AI with the enemy. So I'd be, you know, it was a multiplayer game, but I didn't have anybody to play it with, but I would still play that. But the single player games like Adventure and stuff like that was transformative to me, because all of a sudden I had somebody who was a reliable friend who you couldn't screw it up with.
Sure.
And so I related to that line. And then I started developing the character out from that, you know, with me and Drew Mitchell, my narrative director, who's been with me this entire time on this journey. And I just thought, why, you know, who is she and why is she so, you know, bad with people? And why, you know, what is that character and what is a world that we might build around that character? We sort of started with that, and the initial takes on the world, like fun. I can try to dig up the initial like opening cutscene we did, which is so different. She was there, but there was all this weird stuff that is completely gone from the game. We didn't really know what the Mayflower was. We didn't know what the society was. We didn't know. We may have had the name Mayflower. I'm not sure. But we sort of built the story out from that moment and out from her.
Yeah, right. So is it fair to say then that Judas is more autobiographical than any of your previous works?
I think, it's not an autobiography in any way.
Sure, of course, because just drawing more from your personality and
also her relationship with Scuttle as well. And, we met your dog yesterday.
Yeah, Kirby. It's not just Judas too. Like there's bits of like Tom and Neff and Hope. They're all have chunks of things that I've dealt with. Of course, it's all put through a lens of people on a spaceship a long time from now, dealing with a situation I don't have, but I think there are universal elements. Nefertiti had a very demanding mother who, I don't know if you found in the audio logs from her mom, always disappointed in her, which, and have some of that experience, but also, part of the reason I think I've been successful is I had a mom who was extremely demanding of me and the complexities of that. Mm. And again, it's all through a big lens. It's not like the Ken Levine story, beat by beat at all, but there's a lot, I definitely poured a lot more of my personal experiences in and some of, the good and the struggles as well to inform the characters. And I've also, from a writing standpoint, a lot of the key writing is not coming from me sitting down and trying to write in a sort of dialect, like Infinite and Bioshock both have a certain, Infinite and Bioshock 1 have a tonality to it that's more like period, or even Bioshock is, it's not even really period, it's sort of a patois, more kind of a Guys and Dolls is more of an inspiration for that, where this is a bit more naturalistic.
Hmm.
And so I've done a lot of the writing just by recording myself, like Hope's talking about her. The darkness that she's facing is just me stream of consciousness out to a recorder. By the way, I want to be clear. I have a great writing team. We have a great writer's room. So it's not just me doing all this, but a lot of the sort of the original inspirational beats and the directional stuff is coming me just sitting there trying to just pour it out into a voice recorder. And then, then we massage it and polish it.
Of course. I think it'd be cool to talk about narrative Lego. And it's a complex topic, I think, and I kind of would maybe throw to you to set it up. But I mean, 10 years ago, you gave a speech at GDC where you spoke about this concept to an approach to building games and also, that's to do with the way they're made, but also what the player actually experiences within them. And obviously that's a huge through line for what Judas is. I think we'll talk about this now, but I guess, would you just give us kind of the cliff notes on what that is to sort of set all this up?
Yep. Yeah. So I never want to make a procedural game that was purely driven by math, and algorithms like, Minecraft. And those games are great because, obviously, because you can generate infinite amounts of stuff. But I was like, well, how do you maintain that sort of, the hand of the artist more while allowing for the world to heal itself? That was like when I talked about Bioshock Infinite, if you did something radically different, the world was so rigidly built, there was no way for it to react to you. So I'm like, well, how do you make a world that still feels, because our audience is going to expect, they're not going to want to step down from us in terms of visual presentation. They're not going to want to step down from us in terms of narrative. They're not going to, when I play Minecraft, I'm not expecting a robust narrative experience, right? I'm expecting a very different thing. But from us, people want the things they've had from us before. They want the characters, the world building and all that stuff. But I wanted to do that in a way where the world could pay intense attention to what the player is doing and then rearrange itself around that. So the basic concept, the reason I thought of the term Lego is Legos are a bespoke, handcrafted piece of brick, right? And when I was a kid, they only had a few of them, but now there's a huge library of bricks. And not only are they handcrafted, they know how to interact with each other, right? And it's not code or anything, but it kind of is like mathematically. They build them and they machine them to know how to speak to each other.
Mm-hmm.
But then the user then creates, with these very few elements, creates an infinite amount of content. So that sort of, I started thinking about that idea and how could you apply that to game development? And basically the system, we build handcrafted modular pieces. That could be a piece of art. It could be a texture map. It could be a sub piece of a level, but it could be a piece of dialogue. And, you know, again, we're not heuristically generating, we're not algorithmically generating. We have actors, you know, we have a full cast, but we broke down a lot of the dialogue to what is the smallest chunk that can exist on its own and then combine interestingly with other chunks and to make reactive sentences. So like, for instance, if a character, you're interacting with a character and they are mad at you, right? They might have a lead in that they can pull from a bucket of like, I'm really pissed off of you. Mm-hmm. And then there's another chunk, which is like, because you did X, right? And that X could be very specific, mm-hmm. but those lines aren't recorded together, right? Mm-hmm. They're not thought of together. They have that Lego thing where we know that line, this type of line could lead up to this type of line, which could lead up to that type of line, but they're all modular and they all, and they exist. So it's very difficult because you have to build and every piece of furniture in the game, every encounter, every piece of treasure is basically something we create and then can be placed by us. We train the game to be a good curator of content. Mm. So it knows what the player is doing. It can then react. Oh, the player's been playing really stealthily for a long while, right? Let's try to challenge that, right? And give them an encounter that's much trickier for a stealth gamer. You know, the player is doing this thing and the character's reacting to that. Let's bring in this character, not in a particular cutscene, not in a particular location, wherever you are, whatever you're doing. And it knows, you know, through a very complicated system of like sockets, you know, like, as you said, you're walking down a hallway, Hope will show up. She's leaning against a wall and she's talking to you about arbitrary thing based upon what you've done in a level that's basically being generated through a bunch of tiny little Lego pieces being put together, every piece of furniture, every piece of damage you see on the wall, every poster, all those are being placed by a system at runtime. Now, there are some parts of the opening of the game, just to be clear, is pretty bespoke, you know, the first couple hours. Yeah. But then when you open out into what we call Act Two, then you get into the content that's pretty, you know, the levels are primarily being, I wouldn't say they're procedurally generated. They are pseudo procedurally generated in the sense that we have all this content and the game is putting it together at runtime to react to where you are, where you want to go, making sure you're not seeing things that you've seen recently, you know, because we, you know, keeping that, you know, pacing, the visual pacing interesting, the combat pacing interesting. We have work to do in some of these areas, but we've made big progress in other areas. And we can tune all these things from like central values as well. Mm-hmm. So if the game is like too combat heavy, we can tune values and or too stealth encounter heavy, right? Mm-hmm. Or too gun encounter heavy or too whatever. We can set central values that say, well, you know, after this much of something, maybe the player is going to want something different. And then let's start spawning things a little differently in that direction. If you're working too much for one character, like you're working for Hope, you know, because you're in this competition, the three of them are competing to fly you to Proxima basically to get you off the ship. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, if the player's working too much for one character, because we know that we want them to sort of spend more time playing the field. We want to push and pull between each of them building these three relationships, but they're each sort of vying for your favor. Mm-hmm. We want them to do things like show up and be like, hey, you know what? You've been working for Tom for a long time. You know, they can do things like, if you go and work for me for a while, here's what I'm going to give you. And we know what's in their inventory and we know what they need. And we can give, like Hope is looking at you and saying, you know, what does this person need? When you buy a present for somebody, you're not just buying any object, right? You know that person and you're trying to like say, well, what do they need right now? Mm. You know, what would help them? What would make them smile? What make them happy? Mm. And so we have the knowledge. And so those aren't like pre-written. They're all pulled together. So Hope would say, hey, I know what I've been watching you. You've been doing X, Y, and Z. And maybe you would like this, or I'm watching you and I'm mad because you were helping Tom. And so we want to, and you don't have to do that. Like the game doesn't branch over to that thing. It, you know, she'll go over a level, which is being generated when you get there and their reward will be there, maybe around some tricky encounters or something like that. But we have the ability for them to, you know, to dynamically vie for your attention. They also do it through story. You know, like I think you guys encountered something we call mudslinging where, you know, you get too trusting with one of the characters and the other character will show up and say, let me tell you about them. Mm-hmm. Go with me on this journey and you're going to learn what you're dealing with.
Yeah.
So the Lego system, the narrative Lego system allows us to do all that stuff and to change the world and have that moment. If we were to go rebuild Bioshock Infinite in this, you could say, Elizabeth could say, screw you. Mm. And, you know, and then you'd have to figure out what to do. You know, I think you could, you know, it'd be fun kind of go back to one of my older games and like apply this. Rebuild this. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You know, go to Rapture and be like, oh, well, Andrew Ryan wants me to work for him. And
sure.
Hey, it's not, I'm not, this is not a product announcement. no intention of doing that.
Sure.
But it is, makes me think about, you know, like the limitations of what we worked before. But yeah, the cost was a lot of time and a lot of blood and a lot of sweat and a lot of tears.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, I mean, so kind of seen elements of everything you described, you know, if you think about combat changing in Resident Evil 4, the Nemesis system, even XCOM procedurally generating. You've put all of this into one game. Has it worked out the way that you planned it? Have you had to make some concessions to make it all work?
It's not really concessions. The system, like, you know, if anybody goes back and watch the narrative Lego thing, like Frank the Orc doesn't exist in this game.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Frank exists. Yeah, you met Frank.
Yeah, we met Frank.
I guess I got a thing for Franks. But no, in the sense that I think the system has worked out, at least from what I intended. Again, the audience is going to be the, you know, the determining factor in this. But we've been, a lot of things worked very quickly. Like one of the first things we did was the speech concatenation system, which is the thing that puts different chunks of speech together to make larger things. And we tested and can people tell, you know, and since Centigrade, I know your audience is more sophisticated than most, but I sort of don't want to, you know, I don't even want people to know how the system works because, you know, they, but we tested that pretty early and that worked pretty well, pretty quickly. And that hasn't radically changed much. Things like, you know, the modular system for decorating the world, that was mostly, it worked functionally, but we had a lot of art direction challenges of how do you make this look as good as our previous games.
Yeah.
And that was a much trickier problem. And there is a tendency on a team and to fall back into old ways of handcrafting things because it's faster and easier. Mm. You know, there's a huge upfront cost in a systemic thing, in any systemic game. You know, you mentioned Shadow of Mordor, by the way, which is one of my absolute favorites and another inspirational element for, you know, this game. I actually didn't play it before we had the concept for narrative Lego, but then going back to it, in fact, my executive producer worked on it. And I'm just such a huge fan of that game. And it's kind of a shame nobody's really followed up on that approach.
They made an incredible system.
There are reasons why no one's been able to follow up on that approach. Yeah. As in, like, the Nemesis system is trademarked by Warner Brothers. Yeah. So.
But just look at the conceptual notion of, like, all the orcs being built combinatorially. Sure. You know, and because they're built in a sort of Lego methodology.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And, you know, and, you know, lines of speech and, you know, their hats and you couldn't have done that if all those guys were bespoke because you can literally generate millions of different orcs that feel different from each other and millions of different encounters. So I think, you know, that is one of my favorite games of all time. And XCOM, of course, you know, both the original and Jake Solomon's version of it, you know, and Civilization, those are also modular Lego style games, right? They have a bunch of handcrafted chunks. You know, in Civilization, it's tiles of, you know, rivers and stuff like that. In XCOM, it's, you know, again, tiles.
Yep.
And they generate levels on the fly and they generate events on the fly. You could go, like, I talked to Jake about this. I'm like, dude, you could go, maybe we should get together one day and, like, do something where you have the same narrative support that we have in Judas, but doing a strategy game, you know, because it would work.
Yeah.
I think that you have much more narrative support where your squad mates are talking about what's going on and they're, you know, they're active and there's real narrative, but you're still building basically a Lego. I mean, that game is built very much out of like a Lego concept. All the individual tiles are handcrafted and then the game knows how to heuristically bring in. So a road tile sits next to a road tile, right? Doesn't randomly go into something else.
Mm.
So it's rules based and like our system is rules based.
I'm interested in, cause I watched the narrative Lego talk years ago, watched it again recently. It strikes me that what you're describing here is different and more ambitious than what you initially pitched with that narrative Lego pitch, unless I missed aspects of it. Because my understanding of narrative Lego back in the day, it's very focused around narrative and, like, you know, as in people's motivations, their passions and what gets surfaced,
and the you know, different factional pools and what rewards become available when you cross certain thresholds, when others diminish, et cetera, right? But what you're talking about here is a process of game making that is much more than just narrative. You're talking about literal levels with empty sockets where assets can be plugged in dynamically and so much more, right? So is it fair to say that that concept has been fleshed out and become bigger and more ambitious during development, or did I just misunderstand the talk?
I haven't seen the talk in a while. Sure. So I may be back solving that I had more of the thing at the time than I thought I did.
Sure.
But I think it was necessary to have, if you want the world to be that reactive and still have the same kind of presentation that that people are used to from us, we had to do all the additional work. I know that very early on in development, we had, you know, we were pushing on the environmental modularity and the speech concatenation system. All that stuff was like one of the first stuff we did. So it must have come very soon afterwards.
Right.
I may be misremembering. Like, I may have had, there may have been more. I can't remember exactly when those ideas came about, but I know we started on them very early. We were still in the office in another part of Austin.
Yeah.
And when we were starting on that stuff, and then we moved here. But yeah, it's been around for a long time. But maybe once we started sitting down talking about the problem, or, you know, those things came up. I guess I thought maybe I had more of that in that talk, but
interesting. Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure like procedural generation is that kind of thing where some people really like it and they're drawn to it. And some people are like, oh no, procedural generation. Like, they just sort of don't like that. They really only are drawn to things that are explicitly handcrafted. What would you say to someone that maybe has some hesitancy hearing about the fact that Judas has these procedural elements? You know, how have you been designing to address those sorts of concerns that players might have along the way?
I think if the audience knows, like if the audience can feel that and they can feel this feels like it's coming out of a random number generator, we failed. Right. So again, you know, we have to deliver what people expect of us. We want to give the player what they had from us, but more, not less. And that's what 10 years, you know, part of the reason 10 years is originally, I think I was going to make sort of a more AA kind of thing, more experimental. But as we sort of started falling in love with the characters in the world, I kind of felt like, oh, I really want to go on this journey with Hope and, you know, Tom and these characters. And to some degree, to get that kind of emotional engagement, you know, maybe there are people who can do it. You know, I think there are people who can do it better than I can. Like, if, you know, you play some indie games where they get, you know, real emotional engagement with, you know, very simple pixel art.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think you can do that, but that's sort of, you know, I tend to be more cinematic. We need to build a system where the user's just getting a benefit from it and not paying a cost for it. And that's part of the reason it's taken so long.
Yeah, interesting.
So with everything being pieced together, is this game intended to be like a multiple ending type thing, or is there a through line and an ending? How does it work?
I think that, you know, I don't want to spoil anything for anybody. So yeah, there's multiple ways there's multiple places the journey can take you, depending on, you know, for instance, who you end up being more aligned with. You know, there are some big twists and turns, which we'll, you know, either we'll get into later or we'll let the people discover it on their own. But we want the player to feel that the journey, and I'm generally not in the past been a fan of multiple endings. You know, I sort of notoriously didn't want to write the multiple endings for BioShock. I wanted a sort of a singular, more ambiguous ending. But we're sort of setting out up front that there's these three people and there's different paths you go, but maybe there are other paths too that aren't as zero sum, you know, who knows?
Okay.
I know, but yeah, I'm not going to talk about that just yet. Yeah, the game has to be reactive to the player's decisions and path. And, we want to support that and honor that.
Yeah. Right. I mean, for me personally, I think the most surprising aspect of this is that this is a roguelite.
Oh, yeah.
That was a huge revelation, because when we came here and we're like, all right, it's going to be some BioShock. Sure, of course it is. It's going to have some of that. And we knew the narrative Legos talk from back in the day. And we're like, yeah, there's going to be some of that too. Then we get here and then we die and we're like, what? What do you mean I lost all my stuff? What the hell? So that's huge. You know, that's a massive surprise. Curious how that
came into, like, how that happened? Like, at what point in the development did you be like, hey, that actually is the structure that we're going to go with? Like, when did you commit and how has that been since that decision?
Yeah, to add, is that born more out of the story element or is that just fun factor you found along the way?
Yeah, we were playing, like, we wanted the player to have the ability to fail and try different things. Like, and we never set out, like, you know, there are elements of the game that, you know, you could probably recognize a lot of different inspirations for different games. You know, when you move around the ship, you can probably, you know, recognize some inspirations, you know, on the surface of the ship that we took from other places. You know, but the loop is something, like, we never set out to make a roguelite. I don't think of it as a roguelite. We call the game, you know, when we talk about the game, it's a Judas simulator. What are the tools we can use to tell the story of this woman on the ship in the situation that she's largely the responsible for? You know, you're the prime mover of the story rather than being a Booker or a Jack, you know, showing up. Well, you're more of a prime mover than you thought in those games, but that's a surprise. But right from the beginning, you sort of know that the ship is in the situation it is because of what you did. And so everything starts from that. Who is this character? What is her impact on the world? But we also wanted the player to be able to experiment and make mistakes and fail and fail forward, you know, that they can try things, try experiment, find that's not for them, find it didn't get them the progress they wanted, then try again. I kind of fell in love with the notion of the loop by playing a ton of Rogue. I remember, like, Risk of Rain, I think was the first, the original Risk of Rain was the first one.
The first one?
Well, Rogue back in 1980. Oh, you played Rogue, right? Was, you know, those are brutal, right? You just die and that's the end of the game. Yeah, and I remember playing those games. There's a ton of, you know, a lot of games falling from that. But I never, like, I don't set out to make a shooter. I don't set out to make an RPG. Like, I wasn't, you know, BioShock, you know, it's not, we'd have to call it something because, you know, what do you call it? You know, people categorize that, but I don't think of the game as a roguelite. I think of it as a Judas simulator in that element. And I think, you know, I think we want to keep some surprises for the player when you encounter that. It's not just a shift of perspective from the type of game it is, but it's a huge shift in narrative perspective as well.
Big time.
And you learn this, you know, it's for the first time, I think, that people are like, wait a minute, what?
Yeah.
From a narrative perspective, not just from the loop perspective.
Definitely.
And I don't want to spoil that, but you guys, you know, I think you know what I'm talking about.
Sure. We got that, yeah.
And everything has to be tied to the story. So once we sort of decided that would be interesting to let the player experiment with failure and come back, because that's what roguelites do, right? You screw up by design, right? And then you start again, but you're more powerful and you're more accomplished and you have agency in how you're more powerful. It's not just the game telling you have this or that. So, you know, I really fell in love with that loop, you know, playing. There's so many games I can point to, Dead Cells and FTL, and it's a great game called Undermine, which I love, a little indie game. If you haven't played it, it's great little, like, Zelda kind of roguelite. But I was not ever wanting to make that, you know. I never wanted to make I never set out to make a strategy game, you know, for certain components of the game. I never set out to make a RPG. I set out to tell Judas's story. We set out to tell Judas's story. And then certain things just sort of raise their hand and say, hey, I might be helpful here in telling that story. So we're not hardcore about any of those elements because we're not catering to, like, you know, competitive PvP. You know, obviously we're not competitive PvP, but there's certain things that audience really demands and really expects. And if you're not delivering in that, you're really screwed. We don't really have that problem, you know, except for, I think what people want from us is a cool world, a cool setting, a cool story, cool set of tools to experiment with. But then it just sort of, that gameplay element came in. And then I was like, well, and this is probably one of those moments on my run where I'm on my run, I'm sweating, and I'm thinking, like, and sometimes just it hits you in the notion of the, I don't even want to say the name of the place you go to, that real key change narratively that happens with that was really important to me. And that was tricky to figure out and create a lot of problems, you know, in terms of thinking about the design and challenges, because we had never made that kind of component of the game.
Yeah.
And you can't just assume you're going to be good at it, right? You have to
for sure
play with it and test it. And there's a certain type of reward feeling, like, you don't, especially in our games, I like our games to make that people can get through them. So we're not one of those overly punishing things.
Thank you.
we'll have difficulty levels where you can, you know, and we, you know, where you can be overly punishing. But generally, I think people play our games because they want to be able to experience the experience. Now, in this game, you won't be able to experience the whole thing, because if you end up going, you know, really favoring one of the leaders, one of the big three, there's going to be things you're never going to learn about the other two, and that are be quite surprising and shock you about what you thought about them. So in terms of replayability, outside of the looping replayability aspect, we think there's a lot of replayability in terms of seeing sides of those characters. Absolutely. And what they tell you about the world that you wouldn't have encountered. But I think that, yeah, it became a tool, and then it became a huge narrative opportunity for us. Mm. So I think that for people who worry about that, I think they're going to be, loop is going to be fairly gentle for that, but it's also, I think, going to be extremely narrative rewarding for people.
Like I said yesterday, I was looking forward to dying in a weird way, because
there'll be
subtle changes or new things to discover.
It has that Hades quality where like death doesn't necessarily feel like it's punishing, don't get me wrong. Mm. And you're definitely like, oh damn it. But at the same time, there is a reward that kicks in at that moment for reasons that we won't spoil. But yeah.
I think Greg and those guys who made Hades, that was a huge comfort, that when I played that game, that we saw the narrative audience would embrace that loop, and they'd understand the power of it as a narrative tool as well, right? Because those guys are very story oriented as well.
Yeah.
And so we were working on it, but that sort of gave me, it was a bit of a breath of relief that I saw it could be done, and that from a heavily narrative driven experience, and that the audience would fall in love with it.
Mm. Are there things within the roguelike/roguelite genre that you think kind of are problems that need to be solved? Or were there things in development as you began to apply this that proved very problematic for your game that you needed to solve as you, does that question make sense?
Yeah. The biggest problem, I think, is what Lucy just said, is that you have to not be pissed off when you die. You have to feel like, I am going to go get a new experience narratively. I'm going to feel more powerful coming back in. I'm going to have some interesting choices. You know, in the best roguelikes to me, death is an opportunity. And it has to be, because you know, the original Rogue, death is like a giant punch in the nuts. But some people love it. That's not really for me. Like I played those games, but it was never, because I got frustrated by it. I think that you tuning that curve so it doesn't feel like it's irrelevant, like death has to have meaning and you want to not die, but you also, when you do die, you have to be like, oh, cool. Now there's some new opportunities for me. I can learn something more about, you know, this other place we're talking about, where you go to at that moment, but also, and maybe some things about that place will inform you about the place you're in, you know, sorry, I'm being super vague to your audience, but I don't want to spoil anything. And you know, they'll encounter that fairly early in the game, but I do kind of do want them to encounter that. Mm. But I think that, there's a million ways to do it wrong. And we did it. Like, I think our initial passes at it were just too punishing. And so that's what testing is for. And, you know, so we just, everybody who starts working for us, the first thing they do is they play the game. Many people interview for us, we have them play the game. Mm. And we just suck up, you know, testing data from everybody and get their reaction to things. And yeah, for a long time, we weren't getting that reaction that you're talking about, like you were looking forward to it. And, you know, and what you deal with that is you make sure that, you know, you give them enough reward, you give them enough, like, even like early on, it's like you go to the place and you don't have enough resources to improve yourself, right? And that's like, well, fuck you. Like, well, now I just died and I'm going to go back. I'm no different. And that's hard because, you know, game developers, because we play the game so much, we tend to be really good at it. Mm-hmm. I have a super kind of advantage. For as many games as I play, I'm embarrassingly bad at games.
Same.
You suck?
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm a little better at detecting when the thing's frustrating, because, you know, when you have, especially QA guys who are beating up the game all day, they're so good at it. They're just like, I don't need any of that shit. I'm just going to keep up, you know, soldiering on. And that's one of the hardest problems of game development, is to be the user. I think if I have a talent that's special the talent is that I can play the game and be the user. Even if it's something I've worked on, I can dumb myself down enough from what I know. And like, designers hate me because they'll give me the controller and I'll do exactly the thing that they did, that they didn't. Because designers can often play the game, an encounter, or whatever, the way they want it to be played. Because, and that's, and it's very normal and very natural. It's not a failing. And they're so close to it. Once it high removed from that, I can come into things and even things I know about, I can sort of intentionally put a dumb myself down. And, but even so, compared to the new, entirely new user, I'm sure I'm even like, well, this is fine, but you really have to test to see, you know, what's the right amount of stuff so the player feels happy when that happens. And, and not just like this is, you know, we need our audience, the people who've been following us, you know, they followed us from System Shock 2, which is quite different from BioShock. System Shock 2 is brutal. It's survival, like Resident Evil was our balance inspiration for that. And that's brutal. Every pistol bullet counts, you know, in that game. And BioShock was much more about a game that we wanted you to get through. This game, I think, systemically is closer to, it's somewhere between BioShock and System Shock 2. It's more on that side than towards BioShock Infinite in terms of, you know, the sort of action versus strat planning and thinking and stealth. It's much more back in that space. And I'm happy about that because I sort of, that's, you know, I like that sort of stuff. And so we spent a lot of time getting back to that place and giving the player a lot of agency and how they, you know, how they kid out and how they grow themselves and you know, how they develop as a character. But, you can definitely screw that up. And especially for an audience who may not be expecting that from us. So we want to make sure they're, you know, we spend a lot of time making sure this is going to be a plus for them, not a minus.
Yeah. Bit of a, sorry, just to, on this one. Yeah. In terms of like bit of a weird, like it's kind of weird to hear the guy who made BioShock is now making a procedurally generated roguelite inspired shooter game. You know what I mean? Like that's, I think that's a big surprise. It's going to be a big surprise for a lot of people. Have you ever felt nervous during development that you're like, oh, this is too much. This is too risky. We're piling in too much here. Have you felt that and then held your nerve? Have you maybe had to pull back on some things? Like how have you grappled with how much you're trying to pack into this?
I think, you know, it's funny because the initial reaction, we had this on BioShock Infinite too. I remember we had different headlines when we announced the game. It's like, oh, it's just a BioShock reskin, or oh, it's nothing like BioShock. They just want to call it BioShock because it make, you know, BioShock made a lot of money. And it's frustrating at first because, you know, there's not, people don't know much about the game. And one of the reasons we didn't want to talk about it out of context is I didn't want to really have that conversation. I wanted, you know, this is a kind of weird way we're sort of, this is like the equivalent of like our first cover story, you know, having these conversations with you where we wanted, instead of me telling people it's going to be okay, we wanted people to experience it. And that's dangerous and risky for us because, you know, you guys are going to have your own opinions, you know? But I think that the best thing to do is to show people how it works because we're not trying to fit into a particular category. You know, our games have been weird hybrids of a bunch of stuff, but at the end of the day, it's really about what is Jack's journey through Rapture? What is Booker's journey through Columbia? What is, you know, Judas's journey on the Mayflower and other places. So I think it's very easy though to get freaked out and scared. And I think that's not unhealthy to be scared. I think though you shouldn't be motivated by fear. You should know you have to be aware this is not trivial, especially when you take on something you haven't really done before as a development team. You have to be aware that you're gonna stumble for a while. You have to, you know, and you don't want to, and you're never going to be a place where we're just making a clone of X, Y, or Z, because anytime you make a clone of X, Y, or Z, guess what? It's not going to be as good as X, Y, or Z, because the thing you're inspired by was driven by powerful inspiration and passion. So, you know, I'm not going to make an FTL. I'm not going to make XCOM. You know, like those games are inspiring to me, but I can't make those games. I'm never going to make that kind of game as well as Jake Solomon's going to make that kind of game. Or any of these other developers. So you have to have humility, but you also have to have a bit of courage. Especially, you know, sometimes I'll say things and the team will be like, and sometimes they're really right. There are some versions of like hacking and things like that in the game that, you know, I'll probably talk about this at some point, that were my ideas that were really dumb. And we built them and the team sort of gritted their teeth and I said, no, it's going to be fine. And then it turned out to suck.
Told you, Ken.
Yep. They're very good about not telling you so, but I think they know that if it's not working and it's not testing, I won't hold on to it.
Sure.
Just because I think it's a cool idea and it came from me. But you know, you're going to make mistakes and, you also can't let, you know, initial testing drive you, like, oh, if you have a bad reaction initially, they're wrong.
Hmm.
You then have to tweak and polish and tune and see if you get to the places where people say, I was looking forward to that. Mm-hmm. And that's once you start hearing that, we kept getting closer to that. And there was a lot of time where, because you can hear that feedback initially and think we're totally in the wrong direction. As I said, certain things we have been totally in the wrong direction on, but then you just need the, you know, can you Spartan, like, throw that baby off the cliff? That's a dark metaphor.
They did it there.
You went there.
I'm okay with that. Like, ideas are not the problem. It's execution. It's always execution.
I think with that, I want to jump over to the Mayflower and just everything going on there. The first thing I really want to know is style, where Rapture, Art Deco, like, it's, oh, okay. Like, you understand that language. With the Mayflower, it's got a lot going on. It's like grimy, it's flashy. And then it's contemporary because, like, people are wearing tank tops and t-shirts and sneakers. So what are some of the inspirations behind the Mayflower?
Yeah, it was a lot harder than... With BioShock, and I told this story before, I went to Rockefeller Center one day and I was like, oh, I know what BioShock looks like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was great. And Art Deco is, it reads very well in a low poly setting because it was, you know, it is pretty simple, but very bold. And with, you know, infinite neoclassicism was, you know, a big inspiration from the time period and that, but getting like the quality of sunlight, like, you know, took a long time, you know, like just what kind of blue is the sky? Those things take a long time. This game is much more eclectic and, you know, it's basically neo-Baroque and neo-Victorian. And we have, you know, a bunch of different styles, but they're all unified they draw a lot of inspiration from a bunch of different architectural periods, but they're also embedded with technology everywhere. Mm. And when you look out the window, you're seeing a weird planet and asteroids and all this other stuff in the sky. So it is a very strange mix. And it wasn't something like with BioShock. Once I knew it was Deco, that was a relatively straightforward path. This took a lot more trial and error. And we've been through a lot more architectural styles on this. But sort of once we sort of leaned into, because I do like drawing from existing architectural styles because, hey, there's...
Figured it out a long time ago.
You know, and I didn't want it to feel like generic sci-fi, you know, because for me also the importance is that it feels like a place where people live. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, there are parts of the game that, you know, as you play, because more content is coming, they feel more barren, but sometimes you'll come into a room and it feels, you know, much more, you know, where it has to be, because that's our games have always been, even back to System Shock 2, it always felt very important to me that it doesn't feel like you're in a sanitized combat arena, but this is where people worked and where they lived and they, you know, ate and they had sex and they fought with each other and they had kids and, you know, that these things all have to feel organic and believable for the space to feel like that you're not just in a battlefield. Mm. You know, the sad elements and funny elements and tragic elements. So that was tricky though. And it took us, we kissed a lot. That's many frogs were kissed along the way. But eventually, you know, we sort of landed on that style and then pushing into, like, you know, particular lighting setups of sort of heavy noir, you know, high contrast lighting. You know, you see a lot of that, effects and things like that. And so, you know, sort of leaning into that. And there, I think we drew a lot of inspiration from, you know, we were talking about, cinematographer I was just talking about Roger Deakins, you know, like from Blade Runner 2049, his use of color, you know, we drew a lot of that and we're trying to tightly control the color space. But you know, those are things we've done all along, but I think it's much more eclectic than our previous previous games.
Yeah, definitely. But it's no less striking, I would say, as well. Like, you know, stepping into that space, it's really overwhelming sometimes just to see how imaginative the art design is, and like full credit to the team for what they've produced. It really is like pretty amazing. So yeah, yeah. Interesting.
And they had to do it in this new way where they're not absolutely just handcrafting it. It's all put together, you know, from pieces.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we didn't want to step down from what we had done before. So that, you know, that was challenging.
Oh, for sure. Interested to see, because I mean, that's how Mayflower looks. Interested to hear your thoughts on what the Mayflower says, you know, because clearly we had, you know, Rapture and Columbus, whatever. There were spaces doing a lot of environmental storytelling, yep. You know, and they had different motivations in terms of the messages they were trying to impart. What are you trying to say with Mayflower? Like, what are the things that you're sort of feeding into that? Because you probably don't want to say, well, here's the exact message that I'm trying to put out there with Mayflower. But what are the things that are going, that are in your head as you design this space, stuff that you'd like to explore or touch upon, stuff that you'd like to get the audience thinking about?
Look, I'm always inspired by, you know, I think when I took a class in high school about dystopias, and that's where I first read, you know, Orwell and Huxley and Brave New World and Animal Farm in 1984. And I was, what I love about those stories is how thought out the worlds are. Mm. You know, there's so much detail about the world, and these are just, you know, dystopian places, but they're not like some evil dictator came along and decided to ruin everything for everybody. Things happen for a reason, and unintended consequences is something, you know, when we talk, obviously in Infant, there's a lot of conversations about unintended consequences, even in Rapture, you know, people's attachment to ideology, Andrew Ryan's attachment to this sort of, you know, anarcho-capitalist ideology, but then when the tables turn on him, you know, and he's the losing one, maybe he doesn't hold up to those principles. You know, we all have feet of clay. And so, you know, my reaction to sort of ideology is always, you know, that how does it impact the real world? You know, when it hits reality, you know, and Bioshock was an exercise in that. The Fountainhead, she could arrange it so everything worked out, because she had characters who were basically superhuman, you know, super handsome, super beautiful,
moral,
super adherence to the moral. They had no moral failings on that structure. And I don't know anybody like that. I love the book, but you know, I don't know about it. So Bioshock was my, like, well, what do you put like more real people in that situation for the good and the bad? You know, Rapture's an amazing place, but you know, there are problems. This situation, this game, the first thing I thought about is how can I make a dystopia where everybody could understand how it happened, you know? So the basic setup is that there's a guy named Rosenberg, and he has and this is funny because this is before COVID and before, you know, the appearance of large language models like ChatGPT, you know, appear on the environment, but was using essentially a predictive large language model that was using data from the past to predict the future, which is generally how these things work. You know, when you large language models to some degree are very fancy autocomplete, right? Mm-hmm. They look at a huge corpus of data and they use the past to predict the future. Same kind of like when you read history, it's sometimes easier. Mm-hmm. If you read enough history, it's more easy to predict the future because patterns tend to emerge. So I thought there's another reaction to Infinite. I don't think, like, it was very hard to get on board with Comstock's vision, you know, of Columbia. And that was, I sort of painted myself in a corner there because I didn't really have a good defense for him, you know? Because it's kind of a terrible society. And I think I kind of painted myself a corner. It's too late for me to back out of that corner I painted myself into, of making this world be more understandable and more gettable. But this game starts with a kid who grew up, it's funny, originally this wasn't in his backstory because COVID hadn't happened, but his mother had died and his father was very religious. And his mother, he wouldn't get treatment for the mother because of his religious beliefs, and his mother died. And he sort of cursed his father and cursed God and said, I'm going to make sure that, you know, I'm going to make sure this doesn't happen again. So he originally develops a predictive technology for health outcomes, you know, basically the most fancy, you know, the little crystal everybody has in their hand, that's a data storage device of your molecular state at every second of your life. Mm-hmm. So, if you have that data and then you've worked to reduce privacy laws and we have a huge corpus of data about health outcomes, you can start predicting health outcomes many, many years in the future and radically improve people's health and keep people from dying of things, you know, like, you know, and become more, it's a bit of a fuck you to God, right? No, I'm, you know, all medicine is a bit of a fuck you to God, right? And I don't mean that in a bad way, right?
Sure, sure.
It's saying we're not going to let the natural thing take its course. We're going to intervene. And he wants to intervene. And one day his prediction algorithm tells him that a plague is coming, you know, in the belly, carried around in the belly of 50 billion rat fleas or 50 trillion rat fleas, which is how the Black Death spread around. Mm. And this is before COVID, it's funny. And now we incorporate his backstory that he's been through a plague already, which is very convenient for our story and very inconvenient for all the rest of us in the world. And he has a real mission and an understandable mission. It's literally about the survival of the human species. And we haven't done that. I don't tend to make games about the universe is in danger. You know, it kind of, you know, a lot of the superhero movies, and I'm a huge superhero fan. It is a bit like every time that, you know, the universe is in danger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sometimes the stakes being a bit lower is nice. But this game, I want to make a very grounded characters about an existential risk. And so he makes a ship, you know, he sells all his factories and raises all kinds of money and sells all his homes to build the Mayflower, invites a group of people on board the ship for a generational, many-year journey to fly to Proxima Centauri, where they can start a new, you know, continue human civilization. Most people think they're cranks, you know, and we never actually, you know, well, actually, I won't get into that just yet. And lots of things go wrong.
Mm.
And the mission, as they call it, the capital M mission, getting to Proxima and continuing the survival of the species, is at risk.
Mm.
Certain catastrophes happen, and he starts losing, and they're human, they're results of human error. And over time, he starts losing faith in people and building faith in machines.
Mm.
And out of that, because the stakes are so high, he creates he engineers creation of an extremely dark and dystopic society that you see on the Mayflower. But we want the audience to follow through step by step. So it's not just weird madman, you know, comes up with this. And he was motivated by the most compassionate thing of all time, like wanting the species to continue.
Mm.
But great darkness comes out of that, even the best of intentions.
Mm-mm-mm.
And I mean, that obviously definitely separates him out from Andrew Ryan, from Comstock, because it is a thing that you would connect with. And I love the way that with the big three, their motivations are all so different, but you can see where each of them are coming from. And I think for me, that was when I was, because I was, you know, we had 5 hours of the game. I wanted to kind of push it and see what I could do, but I could definitely feel myself going towards one or the other, and then, you know, say something and I would be kind of conflicted. When writing it, do you have a particular ideology that you have put into one of those three characters that you would go for? Like,
well, mostly with, like,
without spoiling.
No. They all have a bit of experiences that I've been through. You know, Tom feels that, you know, everything is falling apart around him. You know, I've been on projects where I kind of felt everything is falling apart around me, and I felt I wasn't capable of, you know, of steering the ship, but somebody's got to, right? And so he's just the guy's like, things have changed. I now found out I'm a machine and not a person. All my memories are implants. I didn't, you know, most of the things in my life that I thought I did, I didn't do. You know, I'm, and his reaction is, don't care, keep going. Because if he stops, he's going to fall into the abyss. And for Nefertiti, when she found out she was a machine, and this is all because, you know, Judas's actions, you know, caught, and so he just continues on. And remember, they were a family, you know, and that's an important part of the story. It's part of family breakup story. Tom and Nefertiti are husband and wife, and Hope is basically their adopted daughter whose, you know, family died, or they thought their family died in this catastrophe. I mentioned that befell the ship that caused a lot of this. They thought they were a loving family. They had complicated family dynamics like we all do, but they were together. And then this thing happens. Tom says, we're staying on mission. Mm. Hope falls into a pit of existential suicidal despair because, you know, I don't know if you found the audio log where she's talking about her dysmorphic feelings about her body because she thought she was flesh and blood.
Mm-hmm.
And now she feels the electricity and gears moving inside of her. And it's extremely upsetting and distressing. She's not what she thought. She was the ship's Now, Tom is the sort of security officer of the ship. He kept everything in order. He's keeping on with that mission. Hope was the human. She thought she was the most empathetic human like who was ever created. And she and her relationships with people, she was the ship's matchmaker, the ship's therapist. And but she's full of cortisol sensors, and she can smell pheromones in the air. And so the reason she was so empathetic, because she's a machine who was programmed. She also had tons of knowledge about that she shouldn't have, excuse me, about people. One second. So, and all that empathy and all that human connection she had is all a lie. And she doesn't know what to do. It's too painful for her to live. So what she wants out of Judas is to help her end it, because her body won't. The security of, you know, basically her software won't let her die. And she wants to end it because she can't live with the pain of what she has. And she also regrets her role in this whole thing because she knows what a lie it was. Okeke, you know, Nefertiti Okeke is this, she thought she was this world famous biologist who had this mother who was driving her to be great. And she, you know, she cured a certain type of cancer. You know, she thought, well, not for her mother, you know, we'll find out. But, and she was miserable in the Mayflower because she had to keep humans alive in space. She had to keep people, as a biologist, had to make sure that people could survive on Proxima. And really, they don't know what's on Proxima. They don't know, because when you're, you know, we don't really know anything about any exoplanets. We know, we can sense, you know, we think, we speculate about water on them. We speculate, could there be life based on, you know, the Goldilocks principle? And if you're familiar with that, you're not too far from the sun, but not too close to the sun. There's all these things you can guess. But they don't really know what they're getting into. So Nefertiti kind of thinks she's set up to fail. And when she finds out she's a machine and that all her bugs can be fixed in code and she can build a society where, you know, she tells Judas, as you might have mentioned, has some mental health problems of her own and is struggling and has, you know, her weirdness and her anxiety and her inability to interact with people. Nefertiti tells her those are all bugs that can be fixed, you know, and that's a promise she makes to Judas. And she's thrilled with her, like, she's relieved of all this shame and all this guilt. And she can build a society of machines, and she's can solve the perfection problem, because you can perfect machines in a way that's very hard to perfect people. And the question is, you know, what's kept and what's lost in that, you know, in that quest for perfection. So I was, you know, able to explore, you know, Tom, the guy who has to sort of stick with it because he doesn't know what else to do, and Hope, the person who has to come to terms with she's not what she thought she was, and Nefertiti's desire for perfection. These are all things I've, you know, I think we've all had experience with, maybe not in the exact specifics. I have more of the specifics probably, but I think we try to make them relatable as humans, even though they're not, and that they're all, but they've also done terrible things. You know, every character in this game has done some pretty terrible things, even you. You know, I did not want to make a character who's some kind of archetype, perfect heroine. She's pretty messed up and she acted out of rage and she created the situation. But you also, you know, if you've seen the Reckoning Room sequence, you kind of understand why she's deeply angry. And that anger creates, you know, she acts on that anger.
Curious about, I think one of the most striking aspects of the Mayflower as we were exploring it was the way the society demands conformity and the way that that becomes socially shared. You know, there are audio, there are logs that you discover that are actual kind of tweets that have upvotes and downvotes associated with them. And people who are on message, again, lots of upvotes, and people who dare to dissent, again, lots of downvotes. And there's one sequence, which is a sort of public shaming, which we won't spoil the details because I think it's kind of really fantastic sequence to experience. But it's very much about, yeah, public shaming in some very specific ways. In what way is that a sort of commentary on social online discourse and getting cancelled, or is it a sort of more broader approach to, you know, the way history has dealt with the idea of not being welcomed at court? Or how do you, what is that all about?
Yeah, I'm not really a fan generally of like talking about like this particular moment, because I think history, as I, you know, there's this great line, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And if you look at, say, social shaming, this is not a new thing. You know, you look at the Cultural Revolution, you know, in Maoist China. You look at the Red Scare here. You look at the Salem Witch Trials. There's a million things you could look at historically that where society or Inquisition, society uses, or, you know, in East Germany, the Stasi, and, you know, kids reporting on their parents, because it's a very powerful tool, right? You know, there's a line that Hope says when she first comes up with this idea for the society is, you don't need to, you don't need prisons if you can turn people into their own wardens. And so you can enforce norms, sometimes for the good, like there's lots of good norms, like don't murder people, right? You know, don't be awful to people, don't, you know, but then there's norms that are particular to a time period and particular to an ideology. And often in sort of authoritarian societies, you get rigidity towards those norms. And sometimes those norms are, you know, people might be really on board for it. Sometimes it's like, you can't marry a man, right? You know, there are norms all times, and society will use shame and use the, you know, sometimes they use the law, right? Sometimes they use quite often they use norms, you know, hey, that woman's dressed like a slut, right? You know, there are norms that use to shame people, but often they're tools of social control.
Yeah.
And also individual competition. You know, during the Salem Witch Trials, you had people who would turn in their neighbors because they were competitors.
Yeah.
You know,
of course.
Or they were mad at them, or they, you know, they thought their wife, you know, they were competing for a woman. Mm. You know, this is people often then use this. They use it. People use it for, can use it. Now again, I'm not trying to come down on one side or the other, because I'm way more interested in just exploring these questions and having a particular opinion on them, because I don't know everything, you know, but I like exploring these things, especially things that tend to return to society all over and over and over again. And we think we learned the lesson, and we think we're in some unique time where now it's the right time to bring out a particular tool. But then over the fullness of time, these often become times we look back on and say, that must, you know, was that necessarily the best way to go about improvement or societal change? So the Mayflower has every reason. They think it's literally existential. Well, it is literally existential for them. Now, what they do to Judas, and she is a person who does not fit in. She's, you know, there's this ranking system on the ship that's based on social credit, SoCred, they call it. It's actually the money on the ship. Every time you get a like, it's a dollar. And every time you get a dislike, it's a minus dollar. Mm-hmm. So people who are in the negative space are what you call violators. People who are in the positive space are what you call pilgrims. And, you know, so there's this whole incentive to get approval, public approval. But of course, you could also post something that turns out the result isn't what you want. You can end up as a violator for doing that. So the ship has sort of no sexism. There's no racism. Those aren't topics on the ship. But there's always something there's an in-group and an out-group in every society. And we've dealt with it. You know, this is not the first time we've dealt with these topics in our games. But especially when you incentivize it and make it the economy of the world, you can definitely get perverse outcomes. And, you know, a lot of people on the ship spend time trying to figure out, how can I advance myself at, you know, can I advance myself by doing things myself or at the expense of others? You know, also the ship is designed because they don't want people doing any real jobs. They don't want people, you know, deciding who they fall in love with. You know, there's a whole, all aspects of social control, because they don't want people raising children, because that creates instability, and instability creates problems, and problems creates catastrophes, and then the mission might fail. So the stakes are high enough where everybody can tell themselves, well, I'm doing this for a very, very good reason. And they're not entirely wrong, but the unintended consequences are, you push a character like Judas to a certain place, and she throws, and she's going to react. And she's formed in the crucible of that system. And, you know, and it wasn't like she's like, she had problems of her own. She was a person who can't obey, who can't go along with things. She does make problems. She reacts to things and gets pissed off and doesn't follow the rules, and not necessarily always in an adorable, charming way, right? She really fucks with people, but they push her far enough, and she becomes the very thing that they accused her of all along. Would she have become that if not in that society? Don't know. You know, what might she have been if she was in a different place? You know, well, we won't get into that necessarily. But, we kind of look at that as well.
So when playing as well, one thing that I was not expecting was the structure of the Mayflower, because obviously you see the ship and you're like, oh, I'm just going to be able to walk around it as if I'm in Rapture. But it is, you know, there's this kind of overworld map and you get there to each different kind of region, which is then sort of pseudo procedure generated with the help of Scuttle, based after your dog, Kirby. How did that all kind of come together? And the fact that there is this resource management that kind of prevents you from going too far to kind of encourage you to keep
we know we needed a way to get around, you know, and I didn't want it just to be, you know, some random thing, because everything wants to be tied into the narrative. And started thinking about, could it help tell Judas's story? And look, I had a weird experience 10 years ago. Is my wife had wanted a dog for a long time, and that was a constant conversation. We used to call it, if it was the Simpsons episode, can we go to Mount Splashmore? Can we go to Mount Splashmore? It was sort of like that. Can we get a dog? Can we get a dog? I'm like, no. And I really didn't want a dog. And then I didn't get it. I just didn't get it. And then we got Kirby and brought him home the first day. She brought him home the first day. And I was out for a run and I came back. And she was out shopping for him and he was in his little crate and he was shaking and scared. And I was like, oh God, do I have to comfort this dog? And I'm like, there. There's that episode of Seinfeld where George runs over a squirrel and he gets to the, and he's like, you have 45 minutes. And you make that joke all the time. And over time, what I learned to love about a dog, kind of like Judas, they don't judge you. They are completely honest. There's no bullshit. You know, daddy, give me that fucking food, you know? Sure. Sorry, I use the word daddy. We don't have kids. So I'm one of those lame people.
Same.
You know,
no, same.
Yeah.
So, you know, like he's very straightforward. He's very honest. He's not, you know, a lot of times we were working on this character originally because, you know, as you do, he is the craft. He is a big mechanical craft you use to navigate the surface, Scuddy. And he modeled, you know, he's roughly modeled off Kirby. He's got that big snout because my Cairn Terrier was designed to like dig out, you know, dig chipmunks out of holes. But he's also not particularly obedient. And he's kind of a pain in the ass. And it's a big question. Neferdita keeps asking Judas, like, why do you program a robot that doesn't obey? And what I love about Kirby is he's an element of chaos in my life, which I'm pretty structured and ordered. And he stops and makes you not be that way because he'll go off and do something completely chaotic. And he's not, you know, originally people just assumed he'd be like Lassie and he'd be helping you and doing all these great things for you and obeying you. And I'm like, no, that's not the character here. The character is a dog who is kind of crazy. Mm. And Kirby's got a lot of, you know, aggression issues. And so, you know, we had to deal with that. And he's, you know, he's sometimes like, he makes us laugh constantly. He's just really, really funny because he's not that great dog who's, you know, he's not a show dog, you know, in any way, shape, or he's just himself. And like, you know, channeling a bit of myself, I was really interested in the relationship that Judas would have with something like that. And then digging into why she made this thing and, you know, why it exists. And because I've always like, why do I love this dog? I never in a million years thought I would. And now I'm the guy who stops every time I see a dog. Could I greet your dog? You know, I watch the, you know, the dog videos at two in the rescue videos at two in the morning, like with little tears streaming down. And that is not me. You know, people, I don't have kids. Like I'm not that guy, but the dog sort of took me by surprise. And so I just wanted to incorporate that into the experience. Cause I thought like Judas, I can spend a day with Kirby and there's no social anxiety or anything like that. You know, I just hang out with the dude because you can't really screw it up, you know, in the same way. And he doesn't, you never have to wonder like, you know, especially when you get, you know, when you get a little more like celebrity or power, whatever, there's lots of times people meet you and they want something. Now I know exactly what Kirby wants from me. He wants his food. He wants his belly rubs. He makes no beef. There's no intrigue. Mm-hmm. It's very straightforward. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really, really nice. And so I wanted to develop this relationship and it slowly unfolds over time where you understand why she built this thing that sometimes you'll encounter scenes where the dog is really fuck shit up for you. And that's part of the experience of being a dog owner, being a pet owner, you know, in many cases. They're not, unless you have a super trained animal, and I do not. I definitely do not. We tried, it did not work. So I just, you know, brought, it's another element I like brought in, but obviously brought in through a filter. He's a giant robot that you ride around the surface of the surface of the Mayflower, who has a disturbing amount of autonomy at times.
He looks awesome, by the way. The design of him is fantastic. The first time I saw him, I'm like, how big is he? And I'm like, whoa, he's big.
Yeah, your sense of presence. Every time you walk up to him, it's like, whoa.
We like a friendly songbird.
The artist did a great job like bringing him to life and designing him, because they were like, he has a lot of functions. You have to be able to get in him and ride around. You know, and he's based upon a 13-pound Cairn Terrier. And so, you know, his long snout became like the cockpit you sit in and stuff like that. And yeah, over time you'll get upgrades to him.
Awesome. Okay.
It took a lot of work to get right, but I think the animators really took to him, and, you know, we send reference videos from Curb and they, you know, sort of animate off him. They've done a great job.
That's a good segue, I guess, because we really wanted to talk about the enemy designs in the game. They're incredible. There's just, never seen anything like them. Each one of them so distinct. Tell us how that happened, from little locomotives to walking horses and dentist chairs and everything in between. Like, how did that all come about?
Originally, we had sort of more standard robots in the game that you dealt with. And then I was like, why are these robots on the ship? What is their function on the ship? Because we always try to go back to why. Why is this thing here? Everything in the game. Why is it here? And if we don't have an answer for that, it's the wrong thing. So we had a whole class of robots and they weren't very relatable and they weren't very interesting. And then I was like, well, why would they be on the ship? And the computers are weird, right? Like Alexa is not a woman, right? She is a bunch of weird code and algorithms and stuff like that, but yet there's a mask of interface, right? And that could be very disturbing. Like, I think we're talking about, you know, ChatGPT. It sort of even starts scolding you about things. It's a level of interface that I don't really like, but I'm thinking, if you're making a bunch of robots and you want people to be comfortable with the automation on the ship, and that most of the tasks that people used to do are now being done by machines, you better make them accessible to the people on the ship. And so, you know, in the backstory, they were focus tested and all these different designs and, you know, thrown away, you know, and you'll actually probably see some of the stuff in the world where you see the old designs and find out about the focus testing and why people weren't relating to them. And they rejected them because they're alien. So they got more adorable as time goes on. But of course now, since the hack, they're now not so adorable.
Very scary.
And quite dangerous. So they live in this weird tension space. And this is one of those things I think the team initially was like, dude, like the horse was the first one, you know, the deputy horse.
So good.
You're like, what are you doing? Like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, no, just give me a little time. And then I think the moment it clicked for people is when they get aggroed on you and their eyes light up and like-
Their teeth come out.
They get much more scared because they had to like turn into demons at that point. So they weren't working and they were just purely cute, but they're funny. And what is their character? What is their personality? But they also have to start kind of adorably, but also be kind of scary and creepy at the same time.
The dentist chair is like the scariest thing I've ever seen. Yeah. Like the moment the dentist chair stood up, I'm like, fuck.
So speaking of personal experience, I had a period of time where I had a bunch of root canals in that chair.
So
that was another thing. I'm like, what if a dentist chair could, you know, and again, it has a function on the ship. It walks around the ship and when the ship was normal and it gives people dental care and, you know, and it knows who needs the work. Then it becomes a much, I'm sure we've all been in the dentist chair and know, and that's a relatable fear that people have.
I mean, even not even necessarily enemy types, unless I missed something, but, you know, going into the nursery and seeing the kind of nanny bot or the midwife bot
I don't think I did.
It was like the cribs around it and just the moving. It reminded me of the monkeys. The psychological experiment with the wire monkey and
monkey. The wire monkey was a big concept. Yeah, you know, how you raise children. You want to talk about the wire monkey? Yeah. It's interesting. Do you want to?
There was a psychological experiment when it comes to discovering how if it's a nature or nurture. And what they would do is they would put little baby monkeys, take them from their mothers, and they would put them in a cage with a soft toy, basically, so that they could cuddle on it. The other one would be wire to see which one.
And the wire, I think, provided more food.
Yeah. And so even though the wire one provided more food, they would always default to the cloth.
Wow. Okay.
Monkey mother, because it was.
Yeah, right. All yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. Well, that's what's up.
So in that nursery, I was like, wire mother energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, because they, you know, on the ship, they decide at one point people raising their own children was destabilizing. So they had to create a site. And you'll learn more and more about that society. But from, you know, from cradle to grave, you're, you know, the ship is the automatons are taking care of you because they won't screw it up the way we screw it up. The way we screw up our kids, in theory.
Yeah. Sort of looking to, you know, finish up the conversation soon.
Yep.
A few details quickly. Number one, it's an Unreal Engine 4, correct?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Secondly, are you able to share how long an average playthrough might be? Like, what are you anticipating where it's going to land?
We won't know until it's done. And to some degree, we have a fair amount of control over that because so systemic, you can tune things up or tune things down. Mm. And until all the content is in, it's going to be hard for me to say, but it's, I mean, you guys played for how long?
Five hours.
And you're barely scratching this, barely scratching the surface. Yeah. That was a thing that was important to me. Like, I've always valued, I remember saving up for games when I was a kid, you know, and it was expensive. I get an Atari cartridge, like, probably in the 70s, like $30 or $40, which for me back then, you know, is a lot of money.
Sure.
Because, you know, that's back when, like, you know, candy bar was 25 cents. Yeah. But I'm one of those people now. I remember when. And I remember working hourly jobs and how much that was. And every decision you made on that scale, if you bought the wrong game, there, you know, that was a bad thing. So one of the frustrations I had, too, with our previous games is they have limited playtime. Bioshock, Bioshock Infinite. They're linear, limited playtime. And now one solution is you just, like, make a giant world full of, you know, the activities that you've seen in a lot of games, and that the audience has sort of seen that and they're not so satisfied with it. So we really want to not do just, you know, do a big open world game or anything like that, because the story had to be present all the time and making sure, you know, and I hope in your experience, it was pretty present, you know, no matter what you were doing. But I also want to honor that money that people are spending on this game and make sure they're not going to zip through it in a few hours.
Sure.
And the modular approach has helped us do that a lot too, because using this sort of pseudo procedural stuff, you can generate counters and levels and things like that that would be much harder to do. It would take much, much, much longer.
Mm.
So combination of the Lego thing, the development time, and you know, Take-Two's patience has allowed us to do a game. I think it's going to give a lot more playtime, but the goal is rich playtime, not just playtime for playtime's sake. So it could be, you know, we might find out that the game sort of leans to too long, right? And then we will tune it down,
right?
You know, to make it what feels right. But that'll all be based upon players' experience with it. So I don't really have an answer yet, but it's substantially bigger. It's a much bigger game than anything we've ever done before.
Right, okay. And how long, I mean, I'm not sure if you can answer this definitively, but how long do you expect to have left in terms of development time? Like, what do you think? You know, how long is a piece of string? Sure, but like over and under.
Watch me weasel out of this one. You know, it's funny. I think you can tell it's pretty far along at this point. And most of our work left is content tuning, combat pacing, you know. We still have a few more. There's one big feature, which I won't talk about yet, that is still coming in, but most of it's content at this point.
Sure.
Narrative content, level content, art content. But I don't want to make a statement here because I'm going to be wrong no matter what I say. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you, and I'm trying to remember if the trailer said it's 2025 or have you given any window?
We've not announced any
date.
Can
you rule out 2024 at this point?
I don't want to rule in or rule out anything because it's
fair enough.
I've had the situation before we announced the date too early.
Yep.
And then the conversation becomes about the date. And as long as I'm allowed not to do that, I'd rather not do it until I have a high degree of confidence. And for us, the high degree of confidence is, and we keep seeing improving test scores. You know, when that test score for the whole game is where it needs to be, that's when the game will be done.
Sounds like a pretty good approach to making video games.
It's a very lucky approach that we have because Take-Two, you know, look, I wish more publishers would make big bets, but I understand why it's tricky, right? You know, these games have gotten so expensive that it's tricky to do that, but because it's much easier to do the sequel, to do this and that, and there's totally tons of room for that stuff. But in AAA, it almost doesn't happen anymore. And so we're in a fortunate position that we're able to take that kind of risk. And look, we may never know. We may be complete idiots. Maybe I, you know, should have just done, you know, another, you know, game, you know, and continued in a franchise. But I like not knowing where to go. You know, I also like that we're not sort of, I've generally not loved doing sequels. I've done a couple of them. Well, my favorite sequel I worked on was a game I didn't do, worked on the first one, System Shock 2. That was my favorite sequel I worked on because, you know, I had a fresh look at it, but I've really not enjoyed doing sequels. So, but it's hard to get somebody to fund one of these things that is a new IP that has a bunch of new ideas, because when you're doing new things, maybe ideas people aren't interested in. So the way I work with them is I just keep them in the loop. I'm extremely transparent. I built up a lot of trust over the years with them, and they built up a lot of trust in me. But, you know, we will give them a game, and my hope is it's going to be something that's, you know, it's going to make the company proud.
Awesome. And in terms of for you personally, I mean, so you're going to do this, and then what next? Are you going to like kick back and chill out? Are you like, actually, I've already got my next project in mind? Like,
or is it Ken's final game?
Yeah. Like, what's up?
No, you know, I love making games, and I'm not. It's weird because there's not a lot of developers who at my age who have been in the industry as long as I have are still doing it. It is a tough industry, and you know, it takes its toll. I won't deny that. It definitely takes its toll, you know. But I love making games. I love working with people to make something. I like seeing something come from, you know, inception to finish. And, you know, I know I'm going to make more games as long as people will fund them. But I don't know what it is yet. I do think we definitely are going to be continuing the system we developed to make this game. This is the tool I think I want to be building on. Because like I said, it's more like we keep learning new things to do with this. More like a guitar, you know, like than a engine that, oh, you could do tapping and you can put an amplifier on it and you can add distortion. And we keep learning new ways to use the tool set. And most of those are pretty straightforward. Like the amount of narrative content that gone in last couple of weeks just for the thing you're playing, rapid iteration, because the engine, once you know the path of implementing something, you can get stuff in very, very quickly and keep building on it. But then we keep learning new things to do with it, because it is, you know, it's more like an instrument than it is like a tool set.
Well, Ken, thank you for making cool stuff, games we like to play. Good luck to you and the team.
Thank you.
And maybe we'll talk after the game releases. Love to have another chat.
Yeah. I'd love to, too.
Cool.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Wasn't that nice?
That was a really good chat.
Yes.
It was a lot. He was very forthright, really shared a lot. And it was really good.
Pretty
really
straight good. Up.
Yeah.
You know, not bullshitting.
Yeah.
So
totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
So thank you to Ken. Thank you to Ghost Story for that. Also thank you to folks for listening to this, especially if you're new. We know we definitely had a couple of new people coming in to listen to this.
Yeah.
So thanks for checking us out. We are Friends Per Second. We do put out a podcast every other week. We're not every week. So if you want something a little bit more digestible, that's what we do.
Digestible? Yeah. We do a 3-hour long podcast.
3 hours, but also
you can spread it out over 3 weeks.
Yeah, you got a while. Yeah, you got a while to work on
that's
it.
That's right.
Yeah,
just chip away.
And we also had another interesting conversation while we were all together here with another developer that we'll be talking about soon. But for now, this has been us. I'm at Jake Baldino on social media and YouTube. That is Ralph, a.k.a. SkillUp on not Twitter, right?
No, just YouTube, man. Just YouTube. Hell that's been. Yeah. I'm happy.
Are you done with Threads?
I mean, I still dabble. Don't get me wrong. I'm over there, but like,
it's drying up a little bit.
I'm just like, I'm just busy, man. February, I've had like no time for social media, so yeah it's been a lot.
Too many games.
Too many games, man.
Who's this? Lucy.
Hi, Lucy James Games everywhere.
Well, that's it. Thank you guys for listening. We'll see you in the next one. Tie your shoes and go to bed.